Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about the upcoming election, the election. Did I mention the election? Yeah, I'm probably going to talk a little bit about that. Because both camps, both Romney and Obama, are back attacking each other. You know, there was that little moment where they said, well, you know, maybe we should think about somebody else for a second. And then I don't think Romney ever took that moment. He had his little staged event. That was supposed to be like relief, was supposed to be like, well, we're helping, very staged while showing campaign stuff, signs everywhere. It is exactly what it is. But we're going to talk about that, going to talk about the climate, going to talk about, yes, it is getting warmer. What can we do? What should we be doing? Just a thought. Also talk a little bit about how do we rebuild? How do we make sure that what we're doing in a smart way? Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com. The big buzz here in Harrisburg today. TV crews everywhere. Cameraman and all of the little people with their microphones. Turns out Pennsylvania's Attorney General Linda Kelly, she announced charges against former Penn State University President Graham Spanier. He has been charged with perjury, criminal conspiracy, obstruction of justice, endangering the welfare of children, and failing to report the incident to Child Protective Services, which is mandated by law. Kelly, the attorney general, said, look, this was not a mistake. It wasn't an oversight or a misjudgment. This was a conspiracy of silence by top officials at Penn State working to actively conceal the truth with total disregard to the suffering of children. And the question that I ask, if this is the case, this wasn't an oversight, it wasn't a mistake, it wasn't a misjudgment, it was a conspiracy to silence. What about Tom Corbett? Where does Corbett fall in this? And look, we've been saying for a while, you know, what was Corbett's role in this? And how many people are going to come? And I hope they all come. We perp walk them all. But it'll be interesting to see where his attorney general, and, you know, you stop and think about the next attorney general, which is why, you know, in less than a week from today, that attorney general's race is so important. The reason that I think Kathleen Kane has to win so that you have someone who's at least a little bit independent, a little bit not in the good old boys club, not one of them, if you will. I look at Freed, the guy, the Republican running. His father-in-law was a former attorney general. He doesn't talk about that very much. You want to talk about old boys club? And boy, we're going to talk about his father-in-law a little bit later in the program as the former chairman of the Hershey Trust when we talk about what's going on there at Hershey. But, you know, that's why you need to have someone to look into this and someone who's going to actually going to push. Part of me says the reason that they announced this now is so that, well, it's kind of a defensive measure against what will the next attorney general do. Anyway, they also filed new charges against former athletic director there at Penn State, Tim Curley, and one of the vice president, Gary Schultz, who they were already, you know, facing, I guess, perjury and failure to report charges. Also, some new charges there. So that's why the camera crews were crawling. That's the reason the news vans were buzzing. Also, big news, big news. I don't know if you've seen it. The Romney camp has pledged. They have pledged that if they win, if Romney is seated in the White House, he's going to have regular meetings with Democrats. Yeah. He's going to meet with them. Correct me if I'm wrong. And I know I'm not, but correct me if you think I'm wrong anyway. Because I know Obama has had numerous meetings with Republicans over the last 3.5 years. I know that. Right from the very beginning, they had numerous meetings. And how do I know that? I know that because every time they would have a meeting, you would see John Boehner come out and thumb his nose at the president and hold their press conferences to tell everyone that they're thumbing their nose at the president. You had plenty of instances on the floor of Congress where Mitch McConnell and the likes and his likes are saying, well, we're going to make him a one-term president. Kind of makes you wonder, don't you think? So he's going to hold meetings. Oh, how I can't wait. I hope that he holds the meetings in his house there in California with the subterranean parking garage, because I don't want him anywhere near the White House. Although he's going to spend some money here in Pennsylvania. They're going to be doing an ad buy, and the RNC is spending some money. And mark this on your calendar. Sunday, there could be, maybe, possibly, a last-minute campaign stop somewhere in Pennsylvania. It's kind of a where's Waldo thing, or where's Mittens? Or Willard, whichever you'd like. Where's Willard? That's a good one, too. Somewhere in Pennsylvania. Nobody knows where. Nobody knows when. But they know he's coming. Well, according to one of his senior-level campaign officials. Evidently, this senior-level Republican official told The Daily that he was 99% certain, 99% that Romney was coming. And it was going to be really huge. It was going to be a huge rally. It was going to be very successful. And I'm going, well, if you don't know he's coming, never mind. Anyway, this advisor, this official said, the campaign said all along, if you get within a certain margin, we'll come. We'll consider it. Another one said that, you know, here they are, come to the final week, and he says that they've gotten there. The polls that I'm looking at don't show Romney a snowball's chance of winning Pennsylvania. But hey, why not? If it takes some time away from somewhere else, I'm all in favor of it. It would be the first time that Romney had come to Pennsylvania since, well, the sandwich incident, right? You know, it's amazing when he went to Wawa. I think that was the last time he was in Pennsylvania. I know he hasn't been here since Tampa, since the Republican convention. I know he hasn't been here since then because it was a done state by then. I mean, we lost battleground status very early on. Also, some good news for the television stations in the area and across the state. The RNC announced today that they're going to spend $3 million in television advertising. So, yay! And that will put about almost $12 million in Republican spending here in this last week on the airwaves. So, you know, I'm sure the radio stations and the TV stations, very happy. Because that's what these elections have really turned into. You know, a whole bunch of money coming from candidates going to media outlets. And that's concerning to me. Which is why I'm a firm believer of going in, and we need to have publicly financed elections where, you know what, the airwaves are ours. So there should be something where, and I know they get the lowest price on the station, and they get the lowest, it's still a ton of money. And I there's part of me that even like to see, you know, go to what Ross Perot tried. You get a half an hour. What can you put together in a half an hour? What kind of presentation? It'd be interesting to see. Anyway, the Romney was at a campaign event today, Virginia Beach, Virginia. Someone had the audacity to ask about climate change. And, well, you'll hear the person ask.
What about climate? That's what caused this monster storm.
Climate change!
probable, don't you? You gotta love the cover that they gave him. Yeah, I mean, you gotta love that cover. Cause he doesn't, he clearly, you look at the cameras on him, he clearly has no idea what to say. And he's going, he's thinking, how do I not answer this? And then he just doesn't. He just goes on to something else. But what I love, and I gotta be honest, I love that Pavlovian response that Republicans have. They don't like something says, they say, whoa, huh? USA! 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 And they go, wait a second, are you happy that you're wrong? Is that, you don't agree, so you're going to just spew? Look, I'm as jingoistic and as nationalistic as the next person. But my first response is not to chant USA, especially when you're on the wrong side of the issue. And I found it very interesting that the Romney just stood there in silence. Complete and total silence. And what I loved about the frame, where they had the video of Mittens giving the little presentation, there was a guy off stage right holding up a sign that said, "End climate silence." And I'm with you. End it. End the climate silence. Let's start talking about the hell's going on? Why are we having these storms, these 100-year storms every couple of years? And what are we going to do to make sure that we're able to recover from these huge disasters? Which is why I think it was kind of surprising. A lot of people were surprised that Mayor Michael Bloomberg came out today and endorsed Obama. I got to be honest, I never thought Bloomberg would endorse Obama. But he said that Hurricane Sandy had reshaped his thinking. I mean, stop and think about it. I mean, you got nothing out of Romney. Nothing. And when I look at this, and all of these disasters going into the future, you know, what are we going to, how are we going to rebuild? I mean, you stop and you think about how vulnerable this nation really is. When you really look at it, look at what's going on in New York right now. They're without power. They're long gas lines. People are you know, getting all ticked off because they're waiting in line. Our critical infrastructure, our electric grid, vulnerable. Our transportation systems, very vulnerable. You know, nuclear power plants. I don't know, you know, we get a Fukushima type thing. How much trouble are we in? You look at our water infrastructure. You look at our treatment plants. You look at our sewer plants. You look at all that stuff. How much trouble are we in? Our gas lines, our petroleum pipelines. How much trouble are we in? You get storms, take this stuff out. We need to be rebuilding this stuff. And in ways that are going to be able to withstand. And, oh, I don't know, maybe in places that don't have to. Which is why I think we need to be really seriously considering, you know, what we're building and where. But that's a discussion that I don't know that we're going to have. I think jingoism, I think pointing fingers, and I looked at Limbaugh today talking about Chris Christie, and I rarely talk about Limbaugh. But, you know, he went after Christie, something about Greek columns and man love, accusing Christie of having a man crush, or I don't know, something with Obama, because Christie said, you know what, he did a good job. He's done his job. Now, I don't see Christie going the way of Bloomberg and endorsing him, but you know what? You know, has our political discourse gone that far astray that you can't say he did his job? He did the right thing. Not in conservative world. Not in Limbaugh land. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As the East Coast and the federal government works on cleanup, rescue, and recovery from Superstorm Sandy, Republican New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says that President Obama is doing an outstanding job responding to the disaster.
Asked by Fox News whether Mitt Romney would be coming to New Jersey for storm-related events, this was Christie's response.
I have no idea, nor am I the least bit concerned or interested.
Right.
I've got a job to do here in New Jersey that's much bigger than presidential politics, and I could care less about any of that stuff. I have a job to do. I've got 2.4 million people out of power. I've got devastation on the shore. I've got floods in the northern part of my state. If you think right now I give a damn about presidential politics, then you don't know me.
Ohio is playing a vital role in who will win the presidential election, and AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says for the voters of Ohio, it may come down to the auto industry rescue. Trumka says Romney would have liquidated GM and Chrysler had he been president, and he can't seem to etch a sketch that let Detroit go bankrupt comment out of voters' minds. Trumka says the auto industry is one in eight jobs in Ohio. President Obama, Trumka says, stuck his neck out politically by making sure GM and Chrysler and the 2 million jobs that depend on them were rescued without gutting pensions and other benefits for workers. Trumka says the presidency may hinge on that auto industry rescue, and Trumka says a worker voting for Romney is like a chicken voting for Colonel Sanders. GM, Chrysler, reporters, editorial writers, and Joe Biden are all piling on to debunk Mitt Romney's big Ohio lie on Jeep jobs, Jesse Russell reports.
As the Romney campaign continues to run an ad suggesting Jeep plans to move U.S. jobs to China, more headlines are calling the ad out for being deceptive. So far, both Chrysler, which manufactures the Jeep brand, and GM have criticized the ad for being dishonest. In the case of GM, CEO Greg Martin told the Detroit Free Press on Tuesday, "We've clearly entered a parallel universe during these last few days." His reference was to a portion of the ad that said GM was cutting jobs and insinuating those jobs were being moved to China. On Wednesday, Vice President Joe Biden joined the piling on by straight up calling the statement regarding Jeep an outrageous lie. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown told CNN it is the most disingenuous ad he's ever seen. The nonpartisan factcheck.org also weighed in on the ad, calling the sentence about Jeep misleading and flat wrong. The site also points out that the ad says Romney has a plan to help the auto industry. But to date, the candidate has made no such plan, if it exists, available to the public.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something in your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So in the 11th Congressional District, the debate just ended. Gene Stilp was debating the Republican incumbent, the Tea Party incumbent. I go back to this and I go, I don't know why this guy's even in Congress. I don't know. It just is what it is. And you look at all of the nastiness that's gone on the last 2 years, and this guy's been at the center of it and on the wrong side of it. But the debate just ended. I've got Gene Stilp, the Democratic candidate for the 11th District, here on the line. Gene, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick. Nice to be on with you this evening.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking time for me. So, Loophole Lou wouldn't answer the question on Citizens United. What's up there?
Basically, he gets all his money from the biggest corporations in the world. And I said, well, how are you going to close the budget? And the key thing there is that the biggest corporations in the world pay the littlest taxes or no taxes at all. 275 of the largest corporations, 35% of those corporations pay no or little taxes. So I said, this is the burden that the middle class and the small businesses have to take on. They have all the tax burden while these corporations get away with it. I said, so what loopholes are you going to close on the biggest corporations? And he wouldn't answer at all. I said, oil gets $40 billion in loopholes. Why won't you close that? He wouldn't answer it. So, Loophole Lou is his new name. And also he likes to say that he's all for the, pre-existing conditions, and he's all for all that kind of stuff. I said, wait a minute now. You're moving to my position. I said, but you voted to end the affordable care 33 times. I said, what are you doing? Making another loophole for yourself to sneak out of? What's going on here?
Yeah.
So, something like that. But, the guy shouldn't be in Congress, as you said. He is so bad for unions. I can't tell you. Last week I met with the, the unions up at the union up at the Toby Hanna Army Depot up there, that the 5,400 workers, and he's a, this guy Barletta is the guy who voted to basically defund Toby Hanna. So the key thing here is that you know, we got him dead to rights on a lot of stuff, except that he has all this Republican money. We're being outspent 20-1 right now, and he's gone into negative campaigning in a big way to ruin my name, saying I want to take money out of Medicare, which I don't.
I heard that you wanted to steal, that you're stealing right now. $716 billion from my grandmother's Medicare. You evil, evil man.
So when it comes to the, basically it's the Republican tactics to smear the other guy in a big way. And what can I do? He's outspending me 20-1. He has all the, basically the corporate PAC money from Washington, D.C., from the oil, from the bankers, from Wall Street, and also from the insurance companies. So I'm fighting a good fight here. We're going to win this one. We got the Patriot News endorsement yesterday. They left him in the dust. So that's good for Central Pennsylvania, the Patriot News endorsement. And it's always good to have the debate up here in the Levitt Congressional District Port section. That's in Luzerne County. So, and this week he actually showed up for the debate. Last week he didn't show up for the debate in Danville. That covers Danville, Northumberland, and Bloomsburg and Berwick. He didn't show up for that debate. So he sent a surrogate, which amazed me because I just found out that congressional staffers can debate for a political candidate and get paid for it.
Wow.
That's something I'm going to change when I go to Washington, D.C. There's people in jail in Pennsylvania for breaking the laws here. But unfortunately, in Washington, D.C., Congress has arranged for it that people can actually do that. So I was amazed. So that's one of the things I've added to my reform agenda for Congress. But right now, the biggest lobbyists have their stranglehold on Congress. They give all the big contributions to the congressmen. And basically what that means is that the big corporations get all the tax breaks. Small businesses, workers, carry their unfair share of the tax burden. That's what I'm going down D.C. to break up.
I mean, the other part of this, Gene, is, and I remember 2010 when Barletta and the rest of the Tea Party people, you know, came into power, and they said they were going to focus, laser-like focus. I remember this like it was yesterday. Laser-like focus, jobs, jobs, jobs. Yet everything that they have done has been the opposite of creating jobs. I mean, they've created more divisiveness. They've created more gridlock, more of all the things I think are negative. Our credit rating gone to the floor because of their hostage type situations.
Right. The idea was to work on the Simpson bowls, but part of that was to eliminate the big tax cuts for the very wealthy. Okay, but they saw that as increases in tax on the very wealthy, and so they didn't go for it, which leaves us now at the fiscal cliff, right?
Yeah.
That fiscal cliff is a direct result of the Ryan budget and the Republican intransigence in Congress. So the key thing here is to remember a few things. One, they voted four times to eliminate Medicare as we know it. This false voucher program that they're putting in, basically it's going to cost people between $2,000 and $6,000 each, depending on which study you look at, but it's always going to cost everybody a lot of money. So I am for keeping Medicare. I'm making sure that there's no voucher program. I'm making sure that Social Security is not privatized. We got to protect workers. We got to increase jobs. We do that by making sure we lift the burden of taxation off small business who are our job creators. That's what I intend to do. We got to, you know, I'm a fighter. I take this to Washington, D.C. I have a way of pointing out where the problems are and getting the job done as a citizen in Pennsylvania. I'll be much more effective as a congressman in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and I understand tomorrow you're going to have an event here in Harrisburg at the Homeland Center, 1901 North 5th Street, Harrisburg. Tomorrow, I guess, 11 a.m. outside
That's
the
right.
Homeland Center. You're going to have a 15-foot wheelchair.
That's right, because we have to focus on Medicare and Social Security. Saving Medicare is my ultimate goal. I want to make sure that the lies that Barletta has been telling about me, we have to refute that. We don't have the money to go up on TV or on the air, so we have to do that through creative means. And that 15-foot wheelchair speaks to Medicare and Social Security. So that's what I'm going to do, and we'll be there tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. at the Homeland Center. People from all over Central Pennsylvania are residents there. And don't forget, we have millions of people on Medicare, but 17% of them also are on Medicaid. because they're so poor.
Yeah.
And that center takes in Medicare patients, Medicaid patients, and so we have to make sure like centers like that are kept strong, and that's what I'm for.
Yeah, those people in the 47% that Mitt Romney said he didn't care about.
Yeah, I think he doesn't care about 99% of the people.
Excellent point. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Gene Stilp, candidate for the 11th Congressional District. The website, genestilp.com. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Gene's name. A minute ago, you brought up Simpson Bowles, and this is going to be, I think, the focus of next year. I think we're going to see another tax reform bill like we saw in 86, where the working class is going to get screwed again. But this Simpson Bowles thing, this austerity idea, to me, I think is destructive for working people, this idea that we're going to push Social Security off, we're going to cut benefits without going after, well, where the money is and where the revenue is to help fund those programs that are so vital for millions of people across this country.
Trickle down, they're trying to do the trickle down thing again, and we all know what the, we all know what's trickling down on us, nothing, okay? So the key thing here is that they're going to come back with the Ryan plan, the Ryan Romney plan again, or the Ryan plan. And basically that is a pure job destruction, pure job destruction. And again, they're going to try and give this huge tax cut to the extremely wealthy. And we know what's behind it. They're going to try and shift Medicare onto a private program for insurance companies. Who benefits the insurance companies? They have bigger administrative costs. They take profits while Medicare is going to suffer because although it has a less overhead and it's not for profit. So insurance companies control my opponent, Barletta. Insurance companies control Congress. And that's what I'm fighting against. It's amazing. People don't realize that they go to that private, private voucher program. They're going to pay huge amount more. So, you have to, part of my reason for running is to be a clarion call for sanity to point out exactly what Barletta stands for. Barletta will ruin the middle class even more. We'll ruin small businesses. He's not for them. And so that's what I'm trying to avoid. Make sure that Barletta is not the congressman. This is crucial that people get out. And I appreciate everybody voting for me, Gene Stilp, next Tuesday.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, with the Hurricane Sandy and all of the destruction that's come in its wake, I look at people like Barletta. I look at people like Mitt Romney, who don't believe in government. They don't believe in programs like FEMA to make sure that the most vulnerable are taken care of. And I guess it calls into this idea of core function of government. They don't believe that there's anything government should do. Everything should be for a profit. And hey, if you can't afford it, screw you. I'm curious where you fall on the FEMA issue. I mean, we're seeing funding being taken away. We're seeing it being attacked. I'm curious where you're at.
Well, I think let's say the government provides for our defense. The government provides for our safety. These are crucial issues, okay? FEMA has to remain strong. It has to remain streamlined. It has to remain communicative, okay? It has to be there when people need it. You can't do what Romney wants to do, send everything to the states, okay? You need the federal government to act. It's just beyond belief, and I don't think anybody believes that you can take care of disaster relief just at the state level. We have to have the communications abilities that the federal FEMA provides. We have to have the readiness to bring in state contracting with a state for. Let me put it this way: you have to know where you can get the resources in your region, and the FEMA already takes care of that. They can bring in resources, and they're already set up to bring resources in from other regions of the country. Individual states aren't ready to do that. It's just creating a whole other bureaucracy that the Republicans are against. So basically it's total horse manure, the destruction of FEMA. They cannot do that. We will not let them do that, okay?
And at the end of it, it's more disaster capitalism. It's them profiting off of someone else's misfortune.
Exactly. I was at 9/11 in New York City that first weekend searching for the remains of our victims of a terrorist attack. I never want to see that again. But you had to have the coordinated effort that was provided by the state and federal government during the taking care of that terrible disaster. So FEMA is going to stay in place. It's going to be streamlined. It's going to be correctly funded. And there'll be the way every government or agency has some waste that'll be taken care of. But The key thing here is that the key thing here on your show, we have to remember, okay, Barletta basically helped was voted in order to defund Toby Hanna. He missed that vote, okay? He missed what was going on. So I want to make sure that all the defense installations, all the workers in Cumberland County, in central Pennsylvania, I'm trying not to let him touch those installations, okay? Because he'll do the wrong thing. I want to make sure Letterkenny, Mechanicsburg, New Cumberland, the Army War College, the Heritage Museum, Indiantown Gap, all stay strong. In addition to Toby Hanna. So, and also I want to bring in more jobs by bringing more programs to our strong installations here. Basically, you're in a fight against other states and other congressmen about what installations will stay. I'll make sure I fight for those jobs in central Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I want to go back to that because I think that's important. I know the Army War College, the Heritage Center that they have that they've built with, you know, with all the resource there. There was talk of moving it, I think, somewhere to Virginia. So I'm listening to what you're saying, and this vote that he cast, was he the one who said he cast the wrong vote, didn't know what he was? I guess that was Marino.
This was at Toby Hanna, okay? This is a defense vote. And he missed the fact that there wasn't enough money in there to fund, Toby Hanna, okay? The guy who figured it out was Casey and his staff. Casey had that restored, all right? Senator Casey. That's what we have to remember here, okay? We have to remember that we have to vote, solidly, for the president, Senator Casey, and myself to make sure we have a strong defense and that the 11th congressional district is not decimated.
Last line of questioning I've got for you. You know, we've seen a lot of resource taken from the states. We're basically seeing states, you know, pursuing this austerity where we're handing out huge amounts of money to corporations while gutting education. On the federal level, there's got to be something that we can do to stop this beggar thy neighbor economic development where we're handing all of this resource to these big companies that we should be spending on education for our children and health care for our citizens and programs to help our most vulnerable. On the federal level, how would we go about stopping this beggar thy neighbor economic development so states can focus on core functions at home?
Make sure there's no votes for anything like the Ryan budget ever again, okay? They ran it down our throats at least four times via resolution or straight vote the last couple of years, okay? And that gutted education by $118 billion, approximately. It gutted the infrastructure, all right? It gutted our key programs, and so we have to make sure that we don't vote for anything like the Ryan budget. I think they've learned a lesson. I think they've learned a lesson that they can't shove things down our throat. The key thing people have to realize is that we have to have a stopgap in the Senate to make sure, we have to have Casey in the Senate to make sure that we have something that is, that they don't put this insane budget through in case they were ever to get a Republican Senate, it would be an insane situation and the president would have to veto a lot of their bills. So we have to make sure Casey is back there. And then we have to make sure I am there to make sure this crazy Ryan budget that keeps on coming up, that decimates education, decimates infrastructure, decimates working families, decimates the middle class and small businesses, does not pass, all right?
I'm with you.
So that's what I'm up to tonight. Hard debate tonight. You know, you always go out of the debate and say you missed this and missed that, but I made the key points about making sure that I want to keep Medicare strong. I want to make sure that Social Security is strong and I privatize, that we create jobs through small business, making the tax burden go to the largest corporations who hardly pay any taxes. Exxon paid 2%. 2 years ago, GE paid hardly anything, all right? Like I said, these large corporations, AT&T, 8%, Chevron, 4%. So when small businesses are suffering, we have to take the stranglehold that the large businesses have on Congress through the lobbyists and through campaign donations and break that. Barletta has already taken over $100,000 campaign PAC money from largest Wall Street firms, insurance firms, and oil firms. So I'm trying to break that stranglehold in Washington, D.C.
I wish you nothing but the best on Tuesday, Gene, and we'd love to have you back before then to see how things are going. And
love to be back, and just asking folks, vote for Gene Stilp on Tuesday, the 6th.
All right. For more information, GeneStilp.com. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Gene's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break, right back after this. Thanks so much, Gene. Quick break, back after this.
Loudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
If one thing is certain about this year's elections, it's that working families can't afford to sit on the sidelines. The stakes couldn't be higher for American workers. This election is about how we'll move our country forward. We know that can't happen without strengthening the middle class and making sure the wealthy are paying their fair share. And it can't happen without you. Be a voter. Stand up for candidates who stand up for working families. This message brought to you by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters.
According to the self-aggrandizing mythology of America's right-wing rich, Sheldon Adelson is one of society's producers, not one of those morally inferior moochers who are always looking for government handouts. For a reality check on the moral superiority of the rich, however, take a peek at who's now trying to do some of the most egregious mooching ever from the economically devastated people of Spain. Why, it's Adelson, the multi-billionaire casino tycoon from Las Vegas. In addition to trying to buy favors from our own government by throwing as much as $100 million into this year's presidential and congressional elections, the far-right Republican extremist is making a huge financial play in Madrid, Spain. Posing as a magnanimous producer, Adelson claims he'll create 250,000 jobs there by erecting a dazzling, neon-bright $35 billion gambling mecca to be called Euro Vegas. Casinos, hotels, golf courses, four-star restaurants, you name it. Sheldon's corporate development shimmers like a free enterprise mirage for Spaniards suffering from a housing and banking collapse and 30% unemployment. But wait, a mirage is nothing but an illusion. And so is Adelson's free enterprise miracle. In fact, Sheldon the Moocher is demanding that two-thirds of the funding come from the cash-strapped government, which would have to take out bank loans to finance Adelson's profiteering scheme. He's also got his hand out for special tax breaks, and get this, he's even demanding labor law changes so he can bring in cheap foreign labor to build and staff his Spanish casinopolis. This is Jim Hightower saying, what we have here is another example of the ultra-rich's extraordinary sense of entitlement. The dark secret of so many self-proclaimed producers is that, in fact, they're professional, world-class moochers.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
Yes, the best argument we can possibly make. The best argument. This is why I love our governor. Boy, the best argument we can make. Not educated workforce, not good roads and bridges, because we don't have that. Free money. That's the best argument we can make. We embrace free markets, evidently. No, Tom, no. It's all that free money. Free money. Oh, I'll tell you. It makes me worried, you know, in times of crisis, in times of despair, to have folks that just don't get it running our government. I mean, and this is a guy who just doesn't get it. Since this storm, I mean, I think you got to look at this, that it's highlighted the fact that we've got some infrastructure problems. The fact that power is out for so many people. We have and it's not like this stuff doesn't happen often, where you go, okay, well, we're just going to restring them back up so on poles so they come back down. Shouldn't we be considering, you know, figuring out a better way of doing this? You know, every time there's a high wind storm, I hear, don't touch wires when they're down. I go, why the hell are they up? You know, in my neighborhood, they're underground. We can't do that. We can't, evidently not. And you look at what's going on in the aftermath of the storm. And the East Coast has been hammered. And you look at the lingering effects. And there are some major public health effects. They were showing a couple of the towns in New York where, you know, the water is just contaminated. You don't want to walk out in the streets. You know, I remember New Orleans. It was a big soup bowl of oil and chemicals and just nastiness. And sewage, and right now, you know, the sewage treatment plants there in New Jersey and New York compromised. And, you know, people could become sick with, you know, a whole bunch of nastiness. The drinking water, got problems with that. I mean, you start thinking about all the things that we need to be working on. And yet you've got a party who, well, we don't believe in the power of government. We don't believe that that's what should be done. It's not the core function. It's not the role of government. And I was watching one of the fake news on Fox bits earlier. And I've talked about, you know, John Stossel, who is one of the Fox News guys, who over the years has railed against the flood insurance program. Because he built a house on the beach that has been destroyed several times, and he's collected money from it each time, and then he takes the money and he rails against the program. And, you know, nothing really different. He's going to take the money again. And you go, well, you know, look, I get when rich people build these houses on the beach, and, you know, even Limbaugh himself said, you know, those are the 1% that Obama's walking around on the beach with Chris Christie. Yeah, that's the 1%. I agree with him. You build your house on the beach, you shouldn't get flood insurance. You're begging to have it washed away. And I agree with that concept. What about the people who live a block away, 2 blocks, 5, 10? You see, what they're doing is they're using these wealthy people who have, you know, arrogantly, because they're the people who know. They've built these palatial estates on these beaches they know are going to get washed out, and yeah, they end up lobbying to make sure that the flood insurance for them is extremely low, because you know what the claim is? Well, they drive small business, because you know they're creating jobs. So the question then becomes, you know, when you look at this, because if you listen to Stossel, and you listen to the people who want to destroy the National Flood Insurance Program, because he's stupid, nobody else should be able to get it either. You know, because, you know, hey, what if you, I mean, could you make the argument that half the state of New Jersey, all of the city of New York should be not insured? And all of those people who own property should not, I mean, can you make that argument? Of course you can. And then they throw this out there. Well, you know, this should be something for the private sector. Well, you know what? The private sector wasn't doing it. And this is where we do things for ourselves when a for-profit corporation isn't going to. Are there some problems with it? Yeah, I think Stossel rebuilding the same house up on sticks and us paying for that time and time again, yeah, I think there's a problem there. And I agree, we should tear Stossel's house down. But it's the folks who are at the bottom, the folks who are at the margin. And they always use that it's like when I was a kid, they used to play three-card Monte. And nobody ever knew that, you know, the card was never there. It was a sleight of hand. So what they do is they show you one thing. Like Stossel, oh, this big house, we've rebuilt that. Not all of the people that have been helped through the program, not the thousands and thousands of people who have been helped by it. No, not them. So to get back at one idiot like Stossel, we're going to screw tens of thousands, if not millions of people. That's the goal. That's the radical right-wing goal. And it's a shame. It's an absolute shame. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Ocean of Red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone, by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Earth, sky.
For decades, astronomers have been saying that our home galaxy, the Milky Way, was destined to collide someday with the spiral galaxy next door in the direction of the constellation Andromeda.
Now that someday has been assigned a more precise number, 4 billion years from now. Astronomers base this number on painstaking Hubble Space Telescope measurements of the motion of the Andromeda Galaxy.
The Andromeda Galaxy is now about 2.5 million light-years away, but it's inexorably falling toward the Milky Way under the mutual pull of gravity between the two galaxies and the invisible dark matter that surrounds them both. When the two galaxies collide, these astronomers say, our Milky Way will get a major makeover.
And that's not the end of the story. Astronomers also say that long ago, the Andromeda Galaxy closely encountered another large spiral galaxy in our local group. That's a collection of about 30 relatively nearby galaxies. We know this other galaxy is M33, or the Triangulum Galaxy. The astronomers say they can see a telltale bridge of gas between the two galaxies.
For a cool video showing what will happen to Earth's sky when the Milky Way and Andromeda collide, come to EarthSky.org and search for Andromeda Galaxy. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
The goal really is to incentivize companies to come here in Pennsylvania, but not put it under pressure of the taxpayers. The companies have to make the investment. The companies have to hire somebody, or they get nothing. Not one red cent gets laid out by the Commonwealth, as it has in past programs. We think this is innovative and different than what other states are doing.
We're on the free money kick, aren't we? Yeah, evidently, because you know, two segments in a row, leading off first with the governor there saying, "Hey, we embrace free markets. It's not the free money." And you got there Kerry Bettinghoff, who now we find out that you know the bill that he put forth to make sure that, well, all of that state income tax that you think you're paying to your employer, well, you're not. It's your employer. You're paying your employer to pay to the state. It's not going to the state. It's going to them, or at least the first $5 million of it. And then we find out that, you know what? That is just for one company in his district. I mean, really, I mean, you know, the people who told us that they believed in good government, I'm not buying it. And you shouldn't either. They've shown what they believe. Look at the last 2 years. Honestly, the truth of you, look at the last 2 years here in the state of Pennsylvania. Look at what the Republicans have done. You can't say that they've accomplished really anything. Give them credit. Oh, they passed a budget on time twice. And, well, when you have steamroller power, you had better. At least, that's the minimum. That's the barest of minimums that you should at least get your work done on time. When there's no opposition and there's no way of saying, wait a second, that $1 billion you've cut from education each of the last 2 years, should we talk about that? When no one can do that, when no one's allowed to raise their hand and question you, you should be able to get your job done on time, shouldn't you? I mean, really. When no one's allowed to stand up and say, whoa, 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 you're kicking 41,000 low-wage workers off of adult basic? very minimal health insurance plan to help protect, the most vulnerable working people in the state. Yeah, we can't talk about that? No. We have power. We have control. We are the dictators. When he booted 88,000 kids off of Medicaid, nobody said, hey, we shouldn't do this. I mean, they said it, but nobody listened because they don't have the power to block anything. They don't have the power to demand hearings or any of that. Because the Republicans have that kind of control, that kind of steamroller power. But you go and you look at what it is that they've actually done. Look at Act 13. The people who told us they believe in smaller, less intrusive government, they believe in local government, passed Act 13 so that local communities couldn't say whether they would allow drilling to happen in their neighborhood. No, that's going to be consolidated into the hands of the state. Look at the charter school thing that they wanted to ram through, where local school districts, they wouldn't have the ability to say no to charter schools because the state was going to take. These are the people who told us they believe in smaller, less intrusive government. They believe in local government. This is them doing that. The people who say that they're conservative and that they believe in institution and they believe in history and the Constitution, yet floated the idea of changing 224 years of electoral history by changing how we allocate the electors for the presidential election. And why? We all know why. Make sure Romney gets electoral votes. That's why. Same reason they passed this voter suppression law. Oh, well, we want to protect the sanctity of the ballot box. Make people show an ID. Except you old people and you poor people and you college kids. You people who vote for those Democrats. And why are they doing that? Well, not like Mike Terzai said. Going to make sure Romney gets elected. I mean, honestly, Republicans, stop and think about what your party has done. Think about the gerrymandering that they pulled. Ruled unconstitutional. Act 13, which was also thrown out by the state Supreme Court. Unconstitutional. Because it took away local control. These are conservative courts. I mean, these aren't flaming liberals on the court. These aren't the activist judges. But look what they've done. You look at the unemployment compensation bill. To me, that right there, any person who works for a living, you punch a clock and there's a chance that, you know what, you're going to be unemployed at some point. You need to look at what they did. And you got Scott Perry, who's running for Congress now, was one of the architects of this unemployment hit bill. I mean, this is really, stop and think about this for a second. Since 1986, employers have not seen their unemployment insurance premiums go up one bit. In fact, you've seen them go down. Because how the law was written back then, you paid I think it was 1.5% on the first $8,000 of wages. Which at the time, that was about half of the wage base, the taxable wage base. So you were paying, on about half. 1.5% on about half. And as the years have gone on since 1986, inflation has eroded that $8,000 away, which has stayed consistent. So as wages went up, as you went from making, $16,000 to $20,000 to $30,000 to whatever, that $8,000 stayed the same. Until, a couple years ago where that $8,000 was a taxable wage base of about 18 to 20%. So what used to be 50% of the wage base, now down to 20%, paying a 1.5% rate about. So you created this situation where there's no money in the pot. Had that 50% taxable wage base stayed in place, we would have needed no money for the grand collapse. When the Bush recession hit, when all of those jobs, those millions of jobs were lost because of Bush's policies and because of conservative ideology, unemployment would have been fully funded and the program would have been there the way it was supposed to. And we wouldn't have needed to borrow $3.5 billion from the federal government. So by making sure that we didn't raise those premiums on employers over the years, giving them tax breaks every year, we had to borrow money from the federal government to make sure that folks who lost their job through no fault of their own could keep feeding their family. And by the way, keep money in the economy to keep the economy moving along. So we created this $3.5 billion hole that we had to pay back. So what does Scott Perry and the Republicans here in Pennsylvania do? What's the grand idea? Make the employers, you know, help cover the costs since they haven't been paying it for since 1986? No. No, come on. We're going to take it out on people who will be unemployed in the future by freezing the benefits for the next decade, which we know will erode that benefit, will erode that insurance because of inflation for the next decade. So workers in the future who are going to be laid off or they're going to lose their jobs, they're screwed. And so are the small businesses in the community where that money ends up getting. But that's a whole other argument. And on top of screwing the workers, they actually gave a tax break to the companies that underfunded the unemployment compensation system from the beginning. So they raised that $8,000 taxable wage base way up to $10,000 over the next several years, and they cut that 1.5% rate in half. Explain to me. I mean, really, explain to me how this is smart. What this is pandering to the handfuls and screwing the people at the bottom. So I'm telling you, if you work for a living, if you're one of the people who punch a clock, and you got to look at this Republican Party right now and go, these people are radical. These people hate workers. And I know, oh, but Rick, they want to create jobs. Show me. I don't see a transportation bill. Governor's own transportation bill says, you know what? If we don't do anything now, the costs are going to double every 10 years. We've done nothing. The report's still sitting on a shelf somewhere. We know that creates jobs. We know it does. Every $1 billion of federal investment creates 42,000 jobs. That's a Republican number. Stephen LaTourette, the Republican who is retired from Congress from Ohio. His number, 42,000 jobs for every billion we invest. Yet, we don't invest anymore. Why? Because we're too busy giving tax breaks to people who don't need it. We're too busy giving handouts to big corporations who are going to build some, like the cracker plant, $1.7 billion, in a place they were going to build anyway. I mean, we're the dumb ones, I think, in all of this. Anyway, tomorrow, make sure, 11 a.m., you get over to the Homeland Center there, 1901 North 5th Street in Harrisburg, for Gene Stilps. Event to talk about Social Security and Medicare. He'll be there at 11 a.m. with his 15-foot wheelchair. Should be interesting. Gonna take a quick break. Right back with the second hour of the program. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As the East Coast and the federal government works on cleanup, rescue, and recovery from Superstorm Sandy, Republican New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says that President Obama is doing an outstanding job responding to the disaster. Asked by Fox News whether Mitt Romney would be coming to New Jersey for storm-related events, this was Christie's response.
I have no idea, nor am I the least bit concerned or interested.
Right.
I've got a job to do here in New Jersey that's much bigger than presidential politics, and I could care less about any of that stuff. I have a job to do. I've got 2.4 million people out of power. I've got devastation on the shore. I've got floods in the northern part of my state. If you think right now I give a damn about presidential politics, then you don't know me.
Ohio is playing a vital role in who will win the presidential election, and AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says for the voters of Ohio, it may come down to the auto industry rescue. Trumka says Romney would have liquidated GM and Chrysler had he been president, and he can't seem to etch a sketch that let Detroit go bankrupt comment out of voters' minds. Trumka says the auto industry is one in eight jobs in Ohio. President Obama, Trumka says, stuck his neck out politically by making sure GM and Chrysler and the 2 million jobs that depend on them were rescued without gutting pensions and other benefits for workers. Trumka says the presidency may hinge on that auto industry rescue, and Trumka says a worker voting for Romney is like a chicken voting for Colonel Sanders. GM, Chrysler, reporters, editorial writers, and Joe Biden are all piling on to debunk Mitt Romney's big Ohio lie on Jeep jobs, Jesse Russell reports.
As the Romney campaign continues to run an ad suggesting Jeep plans to move U.S. jobs to China, more headlines are calling the ad out for being deceptive. So far, both Chrysler, which manufactures the Jeep brand, and GM have criticized the ad for being dishonest. In the case of GM, CEO Greg Martin told the Detroit Free Press on Tuesday, "We've clearly entered a parallel universe during these last few days." His reference was to a portion of the ad that said GM was cutting jobs and insinuating those jobs were being moved to China. On Wednesday, Vice President Joe Biden joined the piling on by straight up calling the statement regarding Jeep an outrageous lie. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown told CNN it is the most disingenuous ad he's ever seen. The nonpartisan factcheck.org also weighed in on the ad, calling the sentence about Jeep misleading and flat wrong. The site also points out that the ad says Romney has a plan to help the auto industry. But to date, the candidate has made no such plan, if it exists, available to the public.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Someone tell the GOP that Ohio's not for sale. So we're singing, hey, John Kasich, don't sell us out. Hey, Ohio, stand up and shout.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the first hour, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. You know, I look at the stories coming out of New York, long gas lines. The headline, lines grow, tempers flare at gas pumps after Sandy. And you look at all, I saw the reports today, and I keep going, you know, this is the reason that more cities need larger transportation systems. I look at New York. You can ride the public transportation free, as I understand right now, to get people around, which is why I think we need to be investing, well, more. I mean, when these kind of things happen, you need to have the ability to move folks around and stop stuff like this. That's why I've asked Larry Handley. He's the president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU.org, their website. He's in Ohio right now mobilizing riders to get out and vote in swing states and beyond to make sure that, you know, hey, people start thinking about transit, thinking about transportation. Larry, thanks for taking time for me.
My pleasure, Rick.
So
how are you?
I am good. You know, I look at what's going on in New York, and I know we'll get to Ohio here in a minute, but I look at what's going on there, and their public transportation system kind of outdated a little bit. I see some reports of, you know, they're not being able to get parts because our manufacturing not up to snuff. What kind of reports are you getting out of there?
Well, you know, most of the reports we've been getting have been anecdotal from individuals, because here in Ohio, you know, we get hit by the storm as well, and the television in the hotel I've been staying in has been out. So, you know, we're obviously hearing that there's been widespread devastation, not only in New York, but in New Jersey as well. And the transit systems are limping back to life. You know, this was an unprecedented storm caused, in my opinion, by climate change and global warming.
No, don't say that. No, Larry, don't say that. No,
I know.
That's bad.
Well, somebody asked me the other day who should really pay for the repairs of these systems, and I said the oil companies, and I really think that's the
Absolutely.
Truth.
Absolutely. I agree.
Because that's who's polluting the environment, and, you know, when you think about, for example, what happened with the Keystone Pipeline and what's happening with that, and this oil company-funded campaign to convince Americans that, you know, there's no problem or no risk with building that pipeline and ignoring the damage to the Earth's climate that's being done just by taking that oil from the ground is another indication of what the oil companies are doing to us. And if people don't believe there's climate change, all you have to do is look out the window.
Yeah, but if you listen,
New York again, you know, is struggling, and you know, this is the first time the subway was flooded out the way it's been in the last few days, and I think it's very uncertain how long it's going to take to put it all back together.
Yeah, but if you listen to the people like George Will, you know, oh, it's hot because it's just summer.
Right.
I mean, it's
right. 365 days a year summer.
Well, I know some people who wouldn't mind that, but I mean, it's not very good for us as a whole. So now you're in Ohio, you know, talking to folks about public transportation, leafleting. What kind of responses are you getting from folks?
Oh, it's wonderful. You know, not just Ohio. We have thousands of our members all over the United States who are out there now in bus stops. And I mean, literally thousands, handing out leaflets, talking to riders, urging riders who are, by the way, one of the targets of voter suppression, because this is a group of people who often has no driver's license. But all over the country, our members are out there talking to riders about getting out and voting. And I think we're meeting with great success. The riders welcome our members when they do that. And we think the vote is going up among bus and train riders.
Yeah, I would hope so, because, you know, as you pointed out, those are the folks who are targeted for suppression, at least here in Pennsylvania. You listen to, you know, Mike Turzai, the whole reason they passed voter ID, this voter suppression laws, to get Romney elected, who has said not a big fan of public transportation.
That's right. And our members know that, and we're telling the riders that, and I believe it's catching on.
But the bigger picture of this then becomes, you know, activating and educating the riders and the general public about the need for public transportation and the need to be able to move large numbers of folks around. Because, you know, I know where we live here, just coming into Harrisburg every day, it's gridlock and the traffic is a nightmare here. And I can't imagine what 10 more years is going to be without investing in something else or 20 more years. We've got this very short-sighted view of, if I can just get through the next 15 minutes, everything will be okay. But I'm telling you, it's not.
Well, that's right. And you know, in addition to the problems we see in urban America, we are reminded most recently by Tammy Duckworth, who was a candidate for Congress in Illinois and also a war hero who lost both of her legs flying a Black Hawk helicopter. For her country, that riding transit is actually a patriotic act. She joined us, and we produced literature with her statement on it, saying that riding transit not only saves oil, it creates less of a need for foreign oil, which creates less of a need for foreign wars, which saves American lives.
Right.
So it gets much deeper than the obvious, but there's no question that if we don't have a change in Congress and a change in the attitude in this country towards mass transit, that American cities and American people are going to suffer even more.
Yeah, I mean, there's one race that I really want to see go her way. The deadbeat dad. There's one guy that he's got no business anywhere near Congress.
Now, you're right, and every indication is she's going to win, and I think she will be a superstar in Congress, and I also think she will be a very active transit advocate when she gets there. She actually rode the Washington train system, the subway system, when she worked there. And she's a big fan of all mass transit. So I think that you know, her election, which I believe is almost certain, will be great news for transit.
I mean, I make the argument to folks who say, well, I'd never ride mass. I'd never ride a train or a bus. I'd never do that. And I go, but, you know, even if you won't, there are millions of people like me who will. And guess what? I won't be in the car in front of you.
Right. You know, too, Rick, there was recently a poll by the Natural Resources Defense Council, and the poll was conducted jointly by a Republican and a Democratic pollster. And the poll concluded that Americans of every political stripe, whether they ride a bus or a train or a car, believe there should be more funding for mass transit. So this is, I believe, a real sleeper issue in this country. And what we're trying to do is wake up the people who depend every day on transit to get out there and start, you know, vocalizing their support.
Yeah, I guess you could make a free market argument for it. The more choices people have, the better it's going to be. If I've got the choice of driving my car or riding a train, when I lived in Cleveland, where you are tonight, I used to take the rapid transit from where I lived out in the suburbs into downtown, and rode the RTA quite often because it was economical, it was quick, and it was reliable.
That's right. And you know, people say Americans love their cars or have a love affair with their cars, and I think that's not quite the case. they hate the alternative, and we have to provide more transit alternatives so people will, you know, start getting out and socializing on buses and trains.
Yeah, I actually like getting places. I wish I could do away with my car, to be honest. I wish I could come to work on a train.
Well, me too.
So how do we get there? I mean, you know, because we saw when President Obama came into office, there was a whole push towards high-speed rail. There was a whole push investing in this. And what we saw was a major pushback from Republicans across this country. Is this something that we should have maybe couched as Eisenhower did back in the 50s with the highway transportation, with the highway bill, that it's a national defense thing? I mean, how do we get this done?
Well, first, yes, we should, because second, it is. It is a question of national defense. I mean, look at what's going on now. You know, even in New York, where we have a very advanced transit system, we had this climatic event, and now we have, you know, people immobilized all over New York, except for the fact that we do have a bus system. And, you know, as we disinvest in transit, we make it harder and harder for people to get around. But in terms of what do we do, you know, our answer is really simple, and we believe that what the president said recently in an interview on Univision, when he was asked what his biggest mistake was in his first term, he said that his mistake was, and what he's learned from it, his mistake was not reaching out enough, and that you cannot change this country inside Washington. You have to change it outside of Washington. And the entire campaign that the ATU has been involved in for the last 2 years and that we're involved in now in this election is one of respecting our passengers and talking to them like the adults they are and informing them about the value of what they do every day when they ride transit. And I believe that if this, as this campaign continues and we get our riders more involved in the process, then all of these people in Washington, these members of Congress who have dragged their feet and resisted improving transit are going to wake up. You know, one thing, too, you should know, in 75% of the cases, and this is now running for the last 3 years, where the taxpayers themselves, the public, is given an opportunity to vote on raising their own taxes to support transit, they vote yes. 75% of the cases. Now, why isn't Congress doing the same thing?
That's a good question. Why aren't they?
Well, because they don't feel the heat. They do not feel heat from the public, and because I think by the time people get off their bus or train and go home at night, they're too tired to fight anymore about transit. They get back into their lives, and what we're going to do is talk to them every single day while they're on our systems about the importance of doing something when they get off the bus, about screaming at Congress, writing to Congress, and getting something to happen.
Yeah. And the other part of this is, you know, you talk about the economy, and I see Mitt Romney running around saying, well, you know, the economy's not turned around and we aren't creating jobs. I've got a perfect way of creating some jobs.
Yep.
Public investment, rebuild our infrastructure, rebuild our public transportation systems that we used to have in this country, right? We used to have all over the nation.
That's right. And there's no question that investing in mass transit is something that generates more jobs than almost anything else, far more jobs, for example, than building highways. So, you know, but the people don't necessarily know that, and it's one of the best-kept secrets in the United States, and we're out there unmasking the secret.
And that's why I think it's important for groups like yours, like the ATU, to go out and do the hand-billing and do the hard work that, well, our mainstream media is not going to do.
Right. And I can tell you, with respect to that, we have gotten out more than 1 million pieces of literature in this country in the last 2.5 weeks. So, and that's not because Larry said, let's do it. It's because all across the country, bus drivers and mechanics and school bus matrons are taking their own personal time and handing the literature out to their customers, to their passengers, and it's the most effective, most successful program we have ever run. And it's being received so warmly all around the country by our passengers that it's encouraging our members to keep it up.
I'm right there with you, and I encourage you to keep it up because I think it's important. Last line of questioning I've got for you, how long would this take? I mean, there was some push early on during the Obama term to have high-speed rail to connect the country. That unfortunately got shot down. How long would it take to have a reasonable transit system in most major cities and in places like where I live? I would love to see Corridor 1, which they've been talking about for years, link up where I live to Harrisburg so that you could get back and forth and get off the highway.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would take a very long time of building, but the first step is to get the investment. You know, one of the problems with high-speed rail is that it really did not have a big constituency. It really competes directly with airlines, as it should. I mean, there are places right now where people take trips on planes that really should not be done on a plane. You know, if you're traveling, you know, 150 miles, there's no reason to get on an airplane. It's far more efficient if you have high-speed rail. And this country lags far behind the entire world when it comes to high-speed rail, but also to regular mass transit in cities. And the fact of the matter is that mass transit in cities has been cut, fares have gone up, and Congress has intentionally denied us the funding we need to make transit a bigger success. So, you know, it's actually a very long-term guaranteed jobs program that will be wildly popular among the electorate. And that is a message we are pushing not only to the people who ride the system, but we're explaining to people who are in Congress. We have, in the last 10 days, had at least 60 events around the country where members of Congress or candidates for Congress have joined our members in bus stops, on buses, on trains, talking to riders about the importance of transit. And we believe that coming out of this election season, you're going to see more support in Congress for transit. And we're going to keep fighting to make that happen.
And that is the hope. And I hope we make it more affordable, because as you've said, you know, the rates keep going up. And I know folks who, you know, budgets are tight and they're complaining, hey, you know, the rates keep going up. Me, I think you want to incentivize people to ride public transportation to get them off the roads and stop using so much oil and so much gas. It just seems like a natural thing to me.
Well, Rick, we ran a campaign at Staten Island, New York in the mid-90s to do just that, to lower the fare and to get bigger buses and bus lanes. We were successful only because we organized the riders, and the riders went to the governor and mayor and made it happen. And within a year, ridership on the routes between Staten Island and Manhattan was up 120% because the fare went down and the buses got quicker. They were making the trips faster. We believe we can do that all across the country.
I'm with you, and I think it's a great idea. And I hope that as this moves forward, you'll come back and talk to us a little bit more and tell us the successes you're having.
I'd love to, Rick, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Larry, it's always great talking with you. Larry Hanley, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU.org, the website. Quick break, right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show.
If one thing is certain about this year's elections, it's that working families can't afford to sit on the sidelines. The stakes couldn't be higher for American workers. This election is about how we'll move our country forward. We know it can't happen without strengthening the middle class and making sure the wealthy are paying their fair share. And it can't happen without you. Be a voter. Stand up for candidates who stand up for working families. This message brought to you by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters.
According to the self-aggrandizing mythology of America's right-wing rich, Sheldon Adelson is one of society's producers, not one of those morally inferior moochers who are always looking for government handouts. For a reality check on the moral superiority of the rich, however, take a peek at who's now trying to do some of the most egregious mooching ever from the economically devastated people of Spain. Why, it's Adelson, the multi-billionaire casino tycoon from Las Vegas. In addition to trying to buy favors from our own government by throwing as much as $100 million into this year's presidential and congressional elections, the far-right Republican extremist is making a huge financial play in Madrid, Spain. Posing as a magnanimous producer, Adelson claims he will create 250,000 jobs there by erecting a dazzling, neon-bright, $35 billion gambling mecca to be called Euro-Vegas. Casinos, hotels, golf courses, four-star restaurants, you name it. Sheldon's corporate development shimmers like a free enterprise mirage for Spaniards suffering from a housing and banking collapse and 30% unemployment. But wait, a mirage is nothing but an illusion. And so is Adelson's free enterprise miracle. In fact, Sheldon the Moocher is demanding that two-thirds of the funding come from the cash-strapped government, which would have to take out bank loans to finance Adelson's profiteering scheme. He's also got his hand down for special tax breaks, and get this, he's even demanding labor law changes so he can bring in cheap foreign labor to build and staff his Spanish casinopolis. This is Jim Hightower saying, what we have here is another example of the ultra-rich's extraordinary sense of entitlement. The dark secret of so many self-proclaimed producers is that, in fact, they're professional, world-class moochers. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. Fuzzy math. I'm practicing fuzzy math. A lot of times we need to fudge the numbers and not tell the truth. For diplomacy to be effective, lies must be credible.
Missed that guy. Walking punchline right there. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Well, George is in the Cayman Islands right now. Former President George W. Bush giving a big speech to an investment conference there in the Cayman Islands. Organizers saying that people are forbidden from disclosing any of the details about his speech. A spokesman for the Cayman Alternative Investment Summit said the speech is totally closed to all journalists. Nothing. You're not allowed to know. And you got to wonder, you know, how much of that is trying to tell people, hey, how do you shelter your taxes? How do you do the Romney thing? Which is why I still want to see his tax returns. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Bill in line one. How are you doing tonight, Bill?
Good, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. What's on your mind?
Well, speaking in, of neocons and have you ever heard of Joel Skousen?
No, I haven't.
Well, he does a lot of intelligence research. He's pretty big in the alternative radio scene. And anyway, he's pretty well known for his analysis of political inside information. And anyway, he said that Romney, who apparently doesn't really have much of any kind of opinion of his own at all, which is why he's able to flip-flop so readily, has hired Chertoff Associates to
Skeletor. Okay.
Yes, to do his staffing recommendations. So I thought that was real interesting. And Skousen also said that, and he's not really taking a stand one way or the other as far as endorsements, but he's saying that you can pretty much count that if Romney does come into office, you're going to have the same neocon crowd back that was around Bush,
yep.
And you can count on war.
Yeah, no, I don't think anyone's doubted that, and I don't think that's a,
no.
I don't think that's a far prediction.
And I don't think they understand how really serious all this is getting to be. And the other thing I wanted to say in that regard was Ray McGovern, who I'm sure you've probably heard of.
Yes.
Well, he's going to be in Harrisburg on Sunday at the Harrisburg Friends meeting. And there's a number here to call. It's 717-233-3072, Kay Pickering, regarding information. But he's one of the most brilliant, insiders you could ever want to hear to give you some education on what's going on over there.
Yeah, bright guy. Maybe we'll see if we can get a hold of him for
next
week.
That would be super. I'm sure he'd love to come on. The other thing I wanted to bring up, since it's such a major topic of conversation, I'm pretty much was a lifelong, the greater part of my life, resident of the Jersey Shore. I was, right in a number of those beach towns. And, if you look, just let me put it this way, if you look at a map 100 years ago, or not a map, but with photographs from 100 years ago,
right,
you're going to find that there's virtually no construction within a quarter mile or so of the beaches. I mean, it's all open marshes and, it's because people knew, storms come and we don't want to lose our home. So anyway, a little before I was born, they started bulldozing down the dunes. And of course, then the next thing you know, houses started getting built. Well, back in the 70s, we started getting all these very wealthy people moving down, speculators and everything moving down.
Right.
And they started building the mansions and everything on the beaches. Well, the next thing you know, they're filling in marshes all over the place. They're even filling in cranberry bogs, putting up these McMansions, you know. And there's been an ongoing flooding problem ever since. And if you want to really hear something funny, I lived about a block in from the beach. Just over one winter. I rented a place for the winter. And there was this, it was a storm in 93 that did a lot of flooding. So the town managed to get approval to try to reconstruct some of the dunes. Well, these, you know, the better class living in the mansions there, they raised holy hell because it was blocking their view. But it finally got them put in. And then while I was living near the beach there, we got this notice in the mail inviting us, meaning the lower the plebeians, to come down on the weekend and help plant dune grass. You know, it's like you pay for it. You want the damn dune grass. You know, you pay people to bring it in there. It's to protect your houses. So it really became a joke living there anymore. I mean, you talk about class distinctions and class privilege and everything, and I never really believed much in class warfare, but you see it there in, you know, far more so than you see here. I mean, it's downright disgusting.
Yeah, and this is, you know, one of the things I do agree with Stossel's statement earlier that I talked about is, look, you know, you got these people who built, like you said, right on the beach, and you knew they were going to get washed away, and they continually get rebuilt. It's the people like you who lived a couple of blocks in. Those are the folks I want to make sure that get help when they need it.
Yeah, and the thing of it is, because the dunes and everything are gone, the people farther in get flooded out because of their irresponsibility.
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
Yeah, I mean, it's just incredible. I got to the point. I was so glad to get out of there, and you know, my family even said you were prophetic because the area where I lived suffered terrific damage. I mean, you've seen it a lot on the news. It was Point Pleasant Beach.
Yeah, and so. What I hear from the Romney people is, well, you know, let the private sector take care of it. Let the profiteers come in.
No, they'll raise the taxes and you know on the working stiffs and get the subsidies for the. You know, the betters among us.
And you just said you don't believe in class warfare. There it is right there.
No, it is. No, it is. That's what it's come down to. It really has. It's a shame. It's if people could only get a little more educated and wake up to what's going on. I mean, you do a really good job, but, my God, you know, we need 1,000 of you.
Yeah, well, we're trying. I appreciate it, Bill. Thank you so much.
Take care, Rick.
Call back anytime. You know, I mean, you look at this, and he's right. I mean, right there is the dividing line. And you, if you go back and you do look at some of that stuff, he's right. 100 years ago, there was nothing there because they knew you don't build there. That's the buffer zone. But then, you know, some rich people said, hey, I'd like to have a beachfront property. Thank you very much. Because we're better than that. We can, like Rex Tillerson said, we can adapt. We can engineer our way out of all of the problems that we've created. Arrogance. That I think that comes with being part of the wealth class, don't you? Yeah, but I look at this disaster and I look at all the messaging, the Stossels and all of the Romney advisors and all the people, all the messaging. It's all to make sure that those little people don't get taken care of. Because the wealthy, they're going to be fine. Trust me. It's all the rest of them. And, you know, Bill's right. You know, and we've talked about this before with the neocons taking over, you know, Romney's foreign policy. He's not a bright guy in that regard. He's going to put the same Bushians in. We're going to have the same folks, which, you know, you think Iraq was fun. You think Afghanistan was fun. Wait till you see what happens if he gets in and we end up in Iran. Every military person I've talked to says you don't want to get into that. You want to do it diplomatically. You want to use sanctions. You want to do what you can do to avoid putting people in that country. And I would fight against that until he's right. It scares the hell out of me, a Romney presidency. Quick break, right back after this.
I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Teaching America for the better.
If one thing is certain about this year's elections, it's that working families can't afford to sit on the sidelines. The stakes couldn't be higher for American workers. This election is about how we'll move our country forward. We know that can't happen without strengthening the middle class and making sure the wealthy are paying their fair share. And it can't happen without you. Be a voter. Stand up for candidates who stand up for working families. This message brought to you by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
For decades, astronomers have been saying that our home galaxy, the Milky Way, was destined to collide someday with the spiral galaxy next door in the direction of the constellation Andromeda.
Now that someday has been assigned a more precise number, 4 billion years from now. Astronomers base this number on painstaking Hubble Space Telescope measurements of the motion of the Andromeda galaxy.
The Andromeda Galaxy is now about 2.5 million light-years away, but it's inexorably falling toward the Milky Way under the mutual pull of gravity between the two galaxies and the invisible dark matter that surrounds them both. When the two galaxies collide, these astronomers say, our Milky Way will get a major makeover.
And that's not the end of the story. Astronomers also say that long ago, the Andromeda Galaxy closely encountered another large spiral galaxy in our local group. That's a collection of about 30 relatively nearby galaxies. We know this other galaxy is M33, or the Triangulum Galaxy. The astronomers say they can see a telltale bridge of gas between the two galaxies.
For a cool video showing what will happen to Earth's sky when the Milky Way and Andromeda collide, come to EarthSky.org and search for Andromeda Galaxy. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you can feel. Radio is sound salvation. Radio is clean up the nation. So you better listen to the Viceroy reasons. But they don't give you any charge because they think that it's treason. So you have better do as you were told.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Some interesting news. The Louisiana Municipal Police Employees Retirement System, they have sought a court order to inspect the Hershey's books. Shareholders have filed a suit against the Hershey board, claiming, and this is their claim, that the company has long known that their dealings with suppliers that have used illegal child labor in Ghana and the Ivory Coast, and that their suppliers have committed human trafficking violations. So it's interesting to see this public sector pension system going after Hershey and saying, you know, we want to look at the books. We want to know what's going on. And I'm telling you, a lot going on there at Hershey, a lot going on with the trust, a lot going on, a lot of investigation, and there should be. It's about time. Which is why, you know, you look at this election cycle, which is why I'm hoping, you know, not just for what's going on at Penn State, but what goes on in there at Hershey as well. I'm hoping Kathleen Kane gets in there and maybe starts looking into things a little bit differently. You had Corbett who, well, turned a blind eye, and now Kelly who I'm not all that confident in. It'd be nice to see some change, which is why I've asked Rick Fouad, president of Protect the Hershey's Children, group there, a Hershey Reform Advocacy Group. Rick, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you, Rick. Pleasure to be on the show.
You know, I look at this, what's going on there at the Milton Hershey School, the big trust, and all of this, all of the things that are going on over there. It seems like a lot of shady dealings to me.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, the public record is pretty disturbing when you think about it. $17 million used on a luxury golf course, a charitable trust board that tripled its compensation over the last, 8 years. They went from $30,000 a year to $100,000. You had the former board chairman, Roy Zimmerman, total compensation well over $500,000 a year.
Wow.
It's it's mind-boggling, and the idea that the Pennsylvania Attorney General has not only turned a blind eye, but has essentially fostered this kind of conduct is shocking. You've got 31 years of elected Republicans who have allowed this to occur, and during that 31 years, look at the complete failure of the school to use its resources properly and grow. You've got virtually no growth, maybe 100, 200 kids added over that entire time, while billions were added to the charity, and nothing happens. And so all of a sudden, in an election year, Tom Corbett declared on his way out the door that they were starting an investigation, and it's an absurdity. 2 years later, there's still no end to it in sight, and this is information that, he had in hand since 2006. So you're talking about 6 years later, still nothing. And this is the position that Roy Zimmerman's son-in-law, David Freed, is supposed to step into, and we're supposed to expect better from him.
Yeah, I would see that as a major conflict of interest. Your father-in-law was the guy who was the head of the trust there, and you're going to be the guy investigating it. I know he said he'll recuse himself and put somebody else on it, but you got to wonder about that.
I mean, honestly, it's hard to respond without laughing, because think of the things that have occurred. They've got people talk about Sandusky, but what about Charles Koons? You have a parallel pedophile scandal that, in my view, is just as bad as Sandusky. You know, you got a guy who they had a sworn affidavit in, 1998, 99, about Koons, and yet for 10 years he was allowed to run free. They finally arrested him in Middletown. You've got, as I said, the luxury golf course. You've got the self-enrichment. You've got the use of the charity for allegedly for partisan political purposes. And in the midst of all this, the sitting attorney general, David Freed, would be expected to actually appoint a credible, aggressive investigator, an independent guy. It's absurd. And it's not even a knock on David Freed personally. I mean, at the end of the day, how many people are going to really be aggressive about it, about appointing an independent investigator to go after their own father-in-law? Yeah. It's an absurdity.
Yeah, that, it's absolutely absurd. But, I look at this, and you'd said allegedly partisan, and I know that, it's legalese, but you look at someone like Lynn Swann, who, he took his beating running for governor, and part of the way I saw it, part of the reward is he gets to sit on this board, and I'm going, what exactly does he bring to that board that there aren't maybe 100,000 or a million other people more qualified for?
Again, no argument for me, Rick. You're right on the money.
And you look at these sweetheart deals, and the money for sitting on these boards, as you pointed out, $100,000 to sit on for a couple of meetings a year, when we should be using that money to do what the trust was supposed to do. Now, look, I'm not a, I know there are a lot of people who deify Milton Hershey, and his trust has done some great things. The reality is we should be doing at least what the mission was, instead of what we've seen with all the money here recently.
Again, Rick, I couldn't say it better myself. You're taking $100,000 from needy kids and putting them in the pockets of somebody who's already very wealthy.
So what kind of, now, as I understand it, you would probably know much better than I would, what kind of kids ended up going to this school? What was the original idea of the Milton Hershey School? What kind of kids would be brought in, and are those the same kids that they're targeting today?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And so, complicated answer. If this charity were run by credible child welfare professionals, the school would be serving dramatically larger numbers of children. You would be seeing them serve much needier kids, socially needy and probably financially needy, you'd be seeing different kinds of programs. Initially, the school was for, you know, so-called orphans. Over time, that was eroded to allow for kids who had a living parent somewhere. Today, I think that you've got probably kids who are at or below poverty, so there's no doubt that the kids are somewhat needy financially. The big question is whether those kids truly require residential care. Now, that to me is the litmus test, and if they don't, then the school may be doing more harm than good for those kids. Now,
yeah, because I remember, not to cut you off, but I remember not too long ago, it was the last couple of years, there was a story in the paper where a mother had basically given her kids over to the school because she said, hey, the kid's going to get a much better education. And I remember having this conversation with my wife going, I know that the kids are going to get to college and they're going to get all these opportunities, but, you know, as a parent, I don't know that I could give my kids up.
You know, Rick, again, I mean, let's look at one number. In the 8 years that Roy Zimmerman sat on that board, the school graduated 1,126 children. 1,726 kids were removed. Now, think about that. That's on average more than one child every single school day. Those are shocking attrition numbers.
Why were they removed?
Well, so that's the question. Probably because a large number of them really didn't want to be there, didn't belong there. Other ones were removed because the people in charge did not know how to deal with them. Many of the kids were, you know, some of the tougher cases. And so the point is the dysfunction is pronounced that I don't think that these people even understand their own enrollment policies well enough to figure out what kids they should be serving and how they should be serving them today. And again, when you've got a guy running the board and a group running the board, basically for partisan political purposes, self-enrichment, luxury golf, it's not surprising that the poor leadership and the dysfunction flows downstream. You've got senior leadership at the school that's been very, very questionable for the last 8 years as well. And, you know, the result is the kids are being hurt. And I bet you dollars to donuts, Rick, you haven't heard these numbers before because nobody wants to talk about them locally. Everyone wants to just talk about it like it's a big happy story. But when you look at the kids who have been, you know, chewed up and spit out, it's not a happy story. And fundamentally, you say the right thing. If the only thing a child is seeking is a better education, then is this really the right program for them when it's a residential setting?
Yeah. I got to be honest, as I read your article, and it was a great article. We've got it linked at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Rick Fawad's name. It'll take you there. It's Hershey's Charity for Children, became GOP slush fund. We've got it there at the ricksmithshow.com. You know, as I'm reading through this, I'm thinking of all the stories people have told me, you know, anecdotally about how wonderful this charity is and how they help these kids who were like me as a kid growing up in a housing project, you know, giving them opportunity. And I think, wow, this is a great thing. But as I'm reading this, I'm going, you know, they're bringing in billions of dollars. They've got what, I think $8.5 billion in assets, yet not helping as many kids as they could be. In fact, selling off a lot of their property seems to me to be a serious problem.
Absolutely. And the reality is the charity over, you know, 100 years has helped extraordinary numbers of children, and it has provided life-saving intervention for many kids, including me, and I make no bones about that. And it does perform miracles in children's lives. But the test is, what could the charity have done over these decades had it been properly managed? And therein lies the tragedy, because it could have served children on a different order of magnitude, and it could have served them in dramatically, you know, better programs. And today, when you think that they've got almost $9 billion and they're sitting at 1,800 kids, reflect back. In 1970, they had about $200 million, and they served 1,600 kids. So from 42 years, they added just about $9 billion, and only 200 kids were added to the population. And you know, we can talk about where that money went. But, you know, you spend your money on things like luxury golf or, you know, failed businesses, and there's no accountability. Basically, it became a construction bonanza for a lot of people, you know, who were connected to the board. I would also like to go back to your earlier comment about Lynn Swann. It doesn't stop there. Think about it. Tom Ridge gets appointed to the board of the Hershey Company. Barbara Barrett, a prominent Republican from Arizona, gets brought in and put on the trust company board. Let's see, Jim Nevels, another prominent Pennsylvania Republican. Up and down the line, all you see is one Republican after another
right.
getting a very lucrative position. And in that 8 years, Rick, how many child welfare professionals did this board name, did this charity name to its board? And its sole purpose is child welfare. Zero.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like any corporate board, though, and that's what it's become. I mean, I could make an argument for Ridge being on the board. I'm sure you could make an argument for a couple. But Lynn Swann, there to me, there is no argument whatsoever. I don't know how a football player and a guy who got his behind kicked in an election deserves or should be anywhere near the board.
Again, and he is on the Herco board. So then you ask yourself another question. Why are any of those people making $100,000 or $80,000 on that board? Remember,
it's a charity.
This is a company that has basically not returned profits to the charity. The one time recently when they returned profits, it was apparently because they borrowed the money to do it, and it looked like it was just for show. So you've got these guys making all kinds of money at a corporate director fee level, and yet the charity is not even benefiting from it. So, you know, you've got multiple levels of questionable behavior there, Rick.
So as president of Protect the Hershey's Children, how many folks like you who have gone through the program, have gone through this, were former students, former residents, how many people are in your group, and is there a push to try and hold these people accountable?
Well, our group is we basically are an informational group. We're not a membership organization. So, you know, we have a board of five or six people, just a handful, and we put out information, and we just keep lobbying things like the Nation magazine piece or writing letters to the IRS. I mean, we believe that we have attention from the IRS now because, of course, the state authorities have been asleep at the switch. We've tried to bring in media. So, you know, we're a small, tiny group. With a what we would like to believe is a credible, and eloquent voice that's being heard. In terms of supporters, your guess is as good as mine, and I think that our support probably waxes and wanes. We took a stand in defense of the HIV positive child that the school rejected. You may remember this story.
Yes.
We were the only Hershey connected group that stood with that boy, and we were lambasted for it. We got attacked left and right. And so my point is we've stood on principle right up and down the line. We're nonpartisan. We don't care about politics. We care about child welfare, and even when it's unpopular. So essentially, we're an informational group. We don't have members per se. We have quite a big emailing list, and, we just keep cranking out our reports and analyses.
Yeah, because I look at this, and you brought up the kid with HIV there. And,
sure, an absurdity, absolute absurdity.
And I guess, as I was watching the case unfold, I'm going, well, isn't this exactly what this was supposed to do? I mean, aren't these the kind of kids that had fallen through the cracks, and this was like the last place for them?
Well, it's interesting because it was Ryan White all over again. The medical arguments that they were making were totally unsupported. The legal arguments weren't supported, but what they did is there was such a mass hysteria whipped up against this poor child. People became frightened, and the students at the school became panicked, and the alumni became panicked. And so what happened was this snowball effect where this poor kid got thrown under a bus, and it was I was astounded that people who ran a child welfare facility if anyone knew better, it should have been them. And yet they were parading around, long discarded, prejudices that had no business even being in the equation. And of course, look what happened to them. It was a total black eye. And, and unfortunately they made the situation so bad for the child that, naturally he wouldn't want to go to a place where he did not feel welcome.
Right.
So, you're correct. You would think that the school would be run by people who knew better. Until we get transformative change, until that board is, fully removed and reconstituted, until that charity is managed by people who understand child welfare programs, really care about kids, are not serving on the board because they're trying to make a boatload of money, you're going to have this same tragedy repeated over and over and over. I've been in this 13 years, and nothing shocks me anymore. To this day, think about this, Rick. 13 years ago, you know, one of the issues was multi-age housing. You know, I was shocked to find out, you know, that it's still been going on and that they still had, you know, incidents related to it. So the mistakes are being repeated over and over, and it is because of the folks in Strawberry Square. Make no mistake. It's the attorneys general. Tom Corbett was one of the worst offenders for what he allowed to occur. Linda Kelly has done nothing at all. I mean, granted, she's only an interim, but nonetheless, you'd expect more. Mike Fisher, again, you know, he tried, and then he, you know, he totally dropped the ball on his way out the door. He's the reason that Roy Zimmerman was forced onto the board in the first place. So until the people in Harrisburg, or maybe the federal authorities will get involved and the IRS will get involved, but until somebody retools that board and reconstitutes it, you're going to see wasted assets, you're going to see hurt kids, and you're going to see primitive policies. And I think that Pennsylvanians deserve much better with, you know, this magnificent, you know, marvelous, one-of-a-kind global child welfare resource.
Now, I agree with you. I don't have any hope for David Freed to do anything. Do you think Kathleen Kane will answer those questions, or is this even beyond that?
That's a great question, and I think all of us have, you know, seen enough politics to hear people, you know, you have great high hopes and then see him get in office and be just like the other one. But I will tell you that I've observed Kathleen Kane. I observed her one of her talks in Philadelphia. I observed her, her debate with David Freed. And, you know, I think she's made of the right stuff. We're a nonpartisan group, and, you know, we're not Democrat or Republican,
right.
But she looks like she's the real deal. And, you know, why not? If we can keep public exposure, if, you know, radio shows like yours can keep the light focused on this, it'll give, you know, her the support that she needs to make the changes that I think everyone, you know, would like to see happen.
And that's what we need to do. We need to just do.
Indeed. And no respect to David Freed. He seemed like a very nice guy when I saw that debate. He seemed very knowledgeable. He's got a lot of experience. But please, he's clearly a product of the Harrisburg Republican Old Boys Network. You know, it's inconceivable that he's going to, you know, take any genuine action against his father-in-law, against Tom Corbett potentially if he's involved in any of this. At the end of the day, I mean, you know, that's just not going to happen. So I think it's almost by default, but even if it weren't by default, I think that Kathleen Kane has shown that, you know, that she would like to do the right thing. So, you know, let's give her a try. It's been 31 years of Republican attorneys general. We're talking Ernie Prieto, Roy Zimmerman, Tom Corbett, Mike Fisher. You know, maybe it's time to give somebody else, heaven forbid, a female Democrat.
Yeah.
A shot at this.
Yeah, heaven forbid. Someone who might actually, you know, think about the kids for once.
Hear, hear.
You know, and what bothers me is I read your piece, and it's one of the first that I've seen. And again, if you want to read the piece written by Rick Fuad, it's we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Hershey's Charity for Children became GOP slush fund. We've got it there for you to take a look at it. You know, one of the first pieces that I've seen that's actually looked at that, because, you know, I'd like information. I want to know what's going on. I want to make sure that, you know, they're doing what they're supposed to, because after all, you know, some of our tax money goes into that as well.
Indeed, Rick. And the other sad story here is, you know, where's the Pennsylvania media? You know, why aren't they exposing this? You've got Bob Fernandez of the Philadelphia Inquirer. I would encourage your listeners to go to philly.com/Hershey. Check out Bob Fernandez's series, last couple of years. He's done a very, very good job of exposing a lot of this. But other than that, you know, basically it's radio silence. Where's the Patriot News? I mean, now, think about this. In 2003, when they reconstructed that board, who did they, you know, conveniently name to the board that Roy Zimmerman joined? Ray Gover, former publishing editor, I believe that was his title, of the Patriot News. So is it any surprise that the Patriot News has been AWOL on this? You know, and I could go right down the list. But
yeah.
The point is, this is not a conversation that, you know, many folks in central Pennsylvania have heard about, because most people won't take it on. And I credit you and your show for hearing me out today and for having read the Nation piece. I mean, again, the big question is, why isn't anybody else paying attention to this? You've got thousands of needy kids whose lives are at stake. You've got billions of dollars. Pennsylvania's budget would be affected if these assets were used properly. Think about all those foster care kids that, you know, the state is taking care of, and, you know, all the incarcerated adults and adults who are, who don't have life prospects because they didn't have, you know, the childhoods that that this charity could provide. So my point is,
opportunities, right?
Yeah, you would expect more attention, and yet, you know, again, it's sad that a lot of this is first impression, but it begins somewhere, and that's back to our group, Protect the Hershey's Children. So what we keep doing is speaking truth to power. We put our reports out there. We have our website up. You know, we put the papers out. I mean, I try to write, you know, pieces like this. I did a talk that you can access on protectthehersheyschildren.org, which is called The Chocolate Heist, which is just an overview, sort of like the Nation piece. And the point is, as Frederick Douglass said, the arc of history bends towards progress. If you stay in the game, if you stay consistent and principled, if you continue to marshal the facts and speak truth to power, eventually enough people will hear and change will come about. And, you know, hopefully.
And that's what we hope. That's what we hope is going to happen. Again, the piece, Hershey's Charity for Children Becomes a GOP Slush Fund. We've got a link at the RickSmithShow.com. Just click on Rick Fouad's name. It'll take you right there. Rick, I appreciate the time, and I'd love to have you back talk about this more as this unfolds.
My pleasure. Thank you, Rick, and keep up the good work.
Thanks so much. You know, you look at this, though, and, you know, I go back to the, you know, you go back to the H-1B visa thing, you know, last summer. Hershey's got this weird history. You look at the Louisiana, the police union, their pension fund, now saying, hey, we want to take a look at your books. We want to know if you're using illegal child labor overseas. You know, you go, the people who are running these entities, you know, some of the most powerful entities in the area, what are they doing? And are these the kind of people that we want to have in charge? And, you know, and I remember when Rendell thumped Lynn Swann in the election and for governor a couple years back, and I read in the paper that they put him on this board. I'm going, well, there's something up here. How is it that this guy sits on this board, $100,000 a year, something like that? I'm going, explain this to me. How is he qualified for that? Which then leads me into this whole thought of, you know, we really need to look at these charitable boards. We really need to look at all this stuff, because the money that we're spending on these board members, shouldn't we be spending that on, oh, I don't know, the mission of the charity? So again, I go back to, you know, in his piece, you know, I found out, and I didn't know, it's one of those, thanks to his piece, I found out that, you know, Freed's father-in-law was the guy who was the chairman of this damn thing, and you're going to put him in charge of maybe, possibly considering, thinking about, looking into it? I'm uncomfortable with that in a big way. Going to take a quick break, right back with the third hour of the program. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As the East Coast and the federal government works on cleanup, rescue, and recovery from Superstorm Sandy, Republican New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says that President Obama is doing an outstanding job responding to the disaster. Asked by Fox News whether Mitt Romney would be coming to New Jersey for storm-related events, this was Christie's response.
I have no idea, nor am I the least bit concerned or interested.
Right.
I've got a job to do here in New Jersey that's much bigger than presidential politics, and I could care less about any of that stuff. I have a job to do. I've got 2.4 million people out of power. I've got devastation on the shore. I've got floods in the northern part of my state. If you think right now I give a damn about presidential politics, then you don't know me.
Ohio is playing a vital role in who will win the presidential election, and AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says for the voters of Ohio, it may come down to the auto industry rescue. Trumka says Romney would have liquidated GM and Chrysler had he been president, and he can't seem to etch a sketch that let Detroit go bankrupt comment out of voters' minds. Trumka says the auto industry is one in eight jobs in Ohio. President Obama, Trumka says, stuck his neck out politically by making sure GM and Chrysler and the 2 million jobs that depend on them were rescued without gutting pensions and other benefits for workers. Trumka says the presidency may hinge on that auto industry rescue, and Trumka says a worker voting for Romney is like a chicken voting for Colonel Sanders. GM, Chrysler, reporters, editorial writers, and Joe Biden are all piling on to debunk Mitt Romney's big Ohio lie on Jeep jobs, Jesse Russell reports.
As the Romney campaign continues to run an ad suggesting Jeep plans to move U.S. jobs to China, more headlines are calling the ad out for being deceptive. So far, both Chrysler, which manufactures the Jeep brand, and GM have criticized the ad for being dishonest. In the case of GM, CEO Greg Martin told the Detroit Free Press on Tuesday, "We've clearly entered a parallel universe during these last few days." His reference was to a portion of the ad that said GM was cutting jobs and insinuating those jobs were being moved to China. On Wednesday, Vice President Joe Biden joined the piling on by straight up calling the statement regarding Jeep an outrageous lie. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown told CNN it is the most disingenuous ad he's ever seen. The nonpartisan factcheck.org also weighed in on the ad, calling the sentence about Jeep misleading and flat wrong. It also points out that the ad says Romney has a plan to help the auto industry. But to date, the candidate has made no such plan, if it exists, available to the public.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What if you're wrong? What if anybody is wrong in this debate? What if you're wrong? Then I'll have to say I'm sorry. And I wish we could speed up our efforts to reverse the policies that we have supported here at CEI.
Wait,
welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Myron E. Bell from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And, you know, you look at this, you know, this frontline piece that they did on these climate deniers. And look, I mean, they've spent a lot of money. They've done an amazing job of completely shifting the debate. But that quote right there, for me, that's the whole reason. Whether you agree with the climate change, whether I did it or not, that position right there. Well, if I'm wrong, well, we'll have to undo all of the negative stuff we've done. And for me, I mean, we can argue one way or another, but the damage is being done. What we should be doing is try to figure out how we slow it down, how we stop it, maybe even if it's possible, maybe reverse it, which is why I think we need to be talking to people who are rational, sane, and lucid, which is why I've asked Professor Michael Mann, a professor at Penn State University, where he is the director of Earth Science Center, the Earth System Science Center, also the author of two books on climate change, one, Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and the other, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, dispatches from the front lines. Professor Mann, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks, Rick. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, I look at this frontline piece that they just did last week, and, you know, for me, you look at all of the money that has gone into attacking science, that has gone into discrediting science, that's gone into really pushing back at this idea that somehow the planet is warming and, well, we've got something to do with it.
Yeah, it's really tragic, isn't it? Because all of those resources, all of that money could have been spent doing something about the problem, putting in place measures to adapt to the changes that are already locked in that we can't do anything about, while obviously mitigating those changes that we still can by reducing fossil fuel emissions. And we really don't, you know, we couldn't have asked for a better reminder than what has transpired over the past few days with Hurricane Sandy, to see that there is a very real impact, for example, sea level rise. I mean, part of what led to this record coastal surge was the fact that sea levels are a foot already higher than they were a century ago because of global warming. And that means that tidal surge was, you know, a foot higher than it otherwise would have been in the absence of global warming. So that added to the problems associated with that storm. And we need to be, you know, taking measures to protect our coastlines against inundation. We could be spending money on doing things like that. The tens of millions of dollars that unfortunately various front groups have poured into this effort to discredit the science of climate change. Think of all the good that we could have done with that money. And think of the worthy debate that we could be having, right, about what to do about this problem, rather than this fake debate that they've tried to manufacture about whether the problem even exists. I mean, there really is a worthy debate to be had about what policies to put in place to you know, combat global warming, to reduce emissions. There are conservatives like the ex-congressman Bob Inglis of South Carolina, who's leading an effort to establish a conservative solution, a free market solution to this problem. And, you know, I say that's great. I mean, all opinions across the political spectrum are welcome if we're going to debate what to do about the problem. But we can no longer have a worthy debate about whether the problem exists. We can't bury our head in the sand.
Yeah, I mean, but you look at where all the big money has gone, and it's this pushing back against the idea that it even exists. That, well, it's,
right.
I mean, George Will over the summer when it was hot said, well, you know, it's hot because, you know, it's summer, which is kind of the conservative way of putting things, very simplistic, very, well, it is what it is. And, you know, how could we possibly have anything to do with it? So I guess the question I have for you first and foremost is, you know, the science community, this has already been decided, correct?
Yeah, I mean, there is a consensus, a worldwide consensus among scientists that the globe is warming, that our climate is changing, and that humans have the primary role in why.
So then how do we get this across to the general public? Because, I mean, people like me go, look, if there's a problem, let's figure out how to fix it. You know, okay, we know this is a problem. Me burning fossil fuel seems like common sense. I'm putting pollution in the air. That's got to do something, right?
Yeah, and, you know, recent public opinion polls show that actually the public is increasingly accepting the science behind climate change and global warming. I think roughly 70% of the population now recognizes that the planet is warming. A slightly smaller percentage are willing to attribute it to human activity. But public opinion is moving in the right direction. Nonetheless, there's still a huge gulf, right? Because there's, you know, let's say it's 60 or 70% of the public that accept, you know, that climate change is happening, that humans are playing the primary role. But it's, you know, 99.9% of the scientific community. If you look at scientists who actually do research in this area, who publish in peer-reviewed journals, who go to meetings debating, you know, the uncertainties, if you look at what actual scientists are saying, we're not debating anymore whether or not the globe is warming or whether or not we are primarily responsible. The scientific community is debating issues over how much warming will we get. Will we get 3 degrees or 5 degrees Fahrenheit warming, you know, if we raise CO2 concentration to twice pre-industrial levels? How much by the end of the century? Will it be a half a meter? You know, will it be a couple feet? Will it be 3 feet, 4 feet, 5 feet? So, you know, there are aspects of the science that are being debated, but whether or not we're warming the planet and changing the climate and on a collision course with catastrophe if we don't do something about it, that's really not debated.
Yeah. What bothers me in all of this, it's like anything. You know, you go back to, I think it was Mark Twain who, someone asked him if he would participate in the debate, and he said, well, sure, I'll debate whichever the side against is, I'll take that side. Because it's easier to be against something, it's easier to tear something down like this. And what bothers me with this climate denying and all that's a hoax and all of that, is what we're seeing is, in my view, conservative mission accomplished. It's the end of the road to distrust everything. Distrust science, distrust government, distrust any fact. It's just, I believe. And we have, I know people who, they live in the I believe world. And no fact you're ever going to put in front of them is ever going to be enough.
Well, you know, there was that famous saying by Daniel P. Moynihan, the former senior senator of New York, who once famously said, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts. And, you know, for a long time, that was the way the public discourse operated. My own feeling is over the last decade or so, we have seen a complete evaporation of good faith from the public discourse more generally, and I think the poisonous nature of climate change is a loss of good faith in the public dialogue, and it extends to, all areas, all matters of policy. But climate change is clearly one casualty. Our discussion about climate change and what to do about it and our ability to have a fact-based debate about what to do about it is clearly a casualty of this, this loss of good faith and this, this modern, political discourse we've entered into where people feel they're simply entitled to their own facts, whether or not those facts are inconsistent with what the U.S. National Academy of Sciences says, which is that climate change is happening, we're responsible for it, it represents a threat. Or all of the science academies of all the major industrial nations, which have signed on to the same conclusions. So, people don't like the fact that the world scientific community has reached a consensus. They simply invent their own facts, and sometimes, try to make the cynical argument that their opinions are just as valid on this issue as the entirety of the world scientific community.
Yeah, and I saw a lot of that in the piece that Frontline did, and I've followed this for a while, and you see that there are always a handful of scientists that are hired by the ExxonMobils and all of these euphemistically named groups like We Love Sunshine or whatever the names are, Competitive Enterprise Institute or whatever, but they've always got their handful of puppets who they are nicely compensated, the contrarians, if you will, who they're always going to be against the mainstream. Who are the ones that they tout out, they trot out. And we've seen this with this. And I go back to the climate gate where we found smoking gun emails. And I remember talking about that ad nauseum. And now you find out, well, they didn't really find anything.
Well, right. And, interestingly enough, one of the groups is called the Commonwealth Foundation. And it's centered there in Harrisburg.
Oh, the Tea Party think tank, yeah.
Yeah, it's funded by the same a far-right interests that fund, the larger climate change denial machine. Groups like the SCAFE Foundations and the Koch brothers who fund these various front groups and organizations whose role is simply to add noise to the discussion, to confuse the public, to discredit the science, to attack the scientists, to do anything they can to prevent policymakers from actually doing something about this problem. And so, unfortunately, it is these groups that, in large part, are responsible for the poisonous nature of our discourse on this issue.
Well, you bring up the Tinky Tank there and all of the right-wing groups that are preaching this, no government, destroy governments, we've got to get government out of our lives, they're the problem. How is it that you can have policy written by government in a world full of people who want to see government destroyed?
Well,
there
could
be no solution in their world.
They went after me. The Commonwealth Foundation actually ran attack ads against me in our own student newspaper, the Daily Collegian. They ran a smear campaign against me on my own campus in my own, in our own college newspaper. And that was funded by money from right-wing interests who have been actively working to discredit the science of climate change. And so, it really has gotten to the point where it's very nasty, it's very dishonest, it's very disingenuous, and it's very cynical. And, what we're talking about is the future that we're going to leave behind for our children. And I think it's terribly cynical. Not just cynical, but, almost villainous to be trying to delude
and
society
intimidate
about these critical decisions that we're going to make about what sort of planet we leave behind for future generations.
There's something wrong when we're talking about, you're talking about intimidating and harassing scientists who are saying, we want to try and make this a better place to live. But I guess shutting you up is big money.
Well, that's right. When we published my graph, the Hockey Stick, and that's my recent book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, is about my experiences in the center of the climate change debate, where I found myself because of this iconic graph that I published back when I was a postdoctoral researcher, called the Hockey Stick, which demonstrates that recent warming is unprecedented. you know, as far back as we're able to go, more than 1,000 years back in time. It sort of became an icon in the climate change debate. And once it did become an icon, you know, it was a very simple, compelling graphic. You didn't have to understand a whole lot of physics or complicated mathematics to understand what that graph was telling you. And that's what I think made it a real threat to vested interests who don't want to see us act on the climate change problem. And they decided to use their, you know, essentially infinite resources to wage a smear campaign against me and my co-authors and other climate scientists in an effort to discredit this work so that they could cynically claim to have somehow brought down the entire foundation of, you know, human-caused climate change, when in fact, you know, our work was never the central pillar for that case. It was just one of many independent lines of evidence. But it was a very compelling, iconic figure that they felt they needed to take down. And they engaged in a cynical and dishonest effort to try to discredit me, to bring this iconic graph down by bringing me down. And that's what my book is about, sort of my fighting back against that smear campaign.
And if you want to read the book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Frontline, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com where you can pick it up. Click on Professor Michael Mann's name. It'll take you right to a site where you can get it. Also, the book, Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, something that he co-authored as well. We'll have links at thericksmithshow.com. You know, the thing that gets me is I heard Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, not too long ago say that, you know what, this climate thing, things are getting hotter. We'll adapt. We've always adapted. We'll engineer our way out of this. Is it possible? I mean, can we engineer our way out of what's coming?
Well, you know, let me first state that at least it's a move in the right direction, because the former ExxonMobil CEO denied that climate change even existed. So Lee Raymond. So at least Rex Tillerson accepts that it's happening. That's one step forward, or if you like, it's one step down the ladder of denial. But, you know, at the same time, the approach that he's promoting would be a recipe for disaster. You know, the idea that we can somehow engage in some other intervention with the planet and have that magically work out so that it will completely offset this other intervention, you know, the warming of the planet due to increased greenhouse gas concentrations. And so there are various schemes. Some of them are really the stuff of science fiction. I mean, shooting aerosol particles, particulates up into the stratosphere to mimic what a volcanic eruption does, but much more of it and much more often than volcanoes actually do, so that you can try to add this cooling effect to offset the warming effect of greenhouse gases. You know, it might sound like, maybe that'll work at first blush. But it turns out when climate scientists actually look into these schemes in more detail, what they find out is that you could very well end up with a climate that is in a much worse position than the one you started out with. Because while you might offset warming in some regions, you might actually cool other regions, and you might actually lead other regions to warm even faster than they would have if you hadn't engaged in that intervention. So ironically, some of these geoengineering schemes could accidentally end up warming the Arctic even faster.
The
law, I was just going to say, the law of unintended consequences reigns supreme here.
Yeah, and the sad reality is that the people who are closest to the margin, the poor people around this world, not just here in the U.S., they're going to be the ones who suffer. Just like in this latest hurricane, the folks without the resources, the people, the poor folks at the bottom, they're the ones who are going to suffer in this.
That's right. I mean, with climate change, you know, it's often framed as a scientific issue or, you know, a political issue or an economics issue. But to me, it's every bit as much an ethics issue, an issue of intergenerational ethics.
Yeah.
You know, not sacrificing the world we leave behind for our children for the short-term financial interests of cheap energy today, and also these sort of regional inequities that, you know, those who are likely to suffer the most are actually many of those in tropical regions, third world nations, that had little, if any, role in creating the problem in the first place. and yet they are going to bear the brunt of the impacts. It's just ultimately not fair, and I think most people recognize that there's an ethical quandary.
So last line of questioning I've got for you then, you know, how do we turn this around? Because I think most people that I know are sane and rational and say, look, you know, if there's anything that we're doing, there's got to be a way of turning things around. And,
yes.
You know, it doesn't make sense to continue to burn fossil fuels. Is there alternatives? What should we, if you had a policy wand, what direction would we be taking then?
Yeah, and, you know, and I usually stop short of prescribing policy. You know, I see the role of myself as a scientist in informing the discussions of policy. But, you know, no matter how you look at it, there's no question that if we are going to avoid what most scientists have assessed as truly dangerous impacts on the planet from climate change, we are going to need to bring our emissions, our fossil fuel emissions, to a peak within the next few years and ramp them down dramatically in the decades ahead. And so what that's going to require is not, you know, going cold turkey on fossil fuels. We know we can't do that, but we have to incentivize non-fossil fuel-based sources of energy so that we can make that transition. You know, the free market can solve this problem. Some people are surprised when I, you know, advocate letting the free market solve the problem. I believe it can solve the problem, but it has to be operating on a level playing field. And right now, we've stacked the deck by not internalizing any of the costs of fossil fuel burning into the economic cost-benefit analysis, right? Fossil fuel industry, you know, the burning of fossil fuels is degrading our planet, but we're not internalizing the cost in what we pay for the burning of fossil fuels. We need to find a way to do that.
Yeah, I've said that for the longest time. We've externalized all the negative costs that you and I, the people who suffer from it, the people who have asthma and all the breathing problems that come
along with
some of it, and also the cleanup and all that we externalize onto the back of taxpayers. If we made them actually pay what it costs, maybe we would be pursuing other alternatives as well. And I agree. Also, a market-based cap and trade system that a lot have pursued but has completely silent now.
Yeah, and, you know, some of the optimists among us hope that maybe we'll see a more, you know, proactive approach to this problem. We'll see more discussion of this, once we get past this latest election.
Right.
A lot of it obviously hinges on what happens in the election. But, you know, there's some reason to believe that, you know, maybe, you know, progress on this issue isn't, you know, as far away as we might think. It might be around the corner. We just have to keep on, you know, doing what is necessary to move the discussion forward.
Yeah, that's the hope. Professor Mann, I appreciate the time. We'd love to have you back talk about this further as we go down the road. Thanks so much.
We'd be happy to.
Professor Michael Mann, professor at the Penn State University, also the author of two books, one titled Dire Predictions, the other The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. We've got links at therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born.
Values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
According to the self-aggrandizing mythology of America's right-wing rich, Sheldon Adelson is one of society's producers, not one of those morally inferior moochers who are always looking for government handouts. For a reality check on the moral superiority of the rich, however, take a peek at who's now trying to do some of the most egregious mooching ever from the economically devastated people of Spain. Why, it's Adelson, the multi-billionaire casino tycoon from Las Vegas. In addition to trying to buy favors from our own government by throwing as much as $100 million into this year's presidential and congressional elections, the far-right Republican extremist is making a huge financial play in Madrid, Spain. Posing as a magnanimous producer, Adelson claims he will create 250,000 jobs there by erecting a dazzling, neon-bright $35 billion gambling mecca to be called Euro Vegas. Casinos, hotels, golf courses, four-star restaurants, you name it. Sheldon's corporate development shimmers like a free enterprise mirage for Spaniards suffering from a housing and banking collapse and 30% unemployment. But wait, a mirage is nothing but an illusion. And so is Adelson's free enterprise miracle. In fact, Sheldon the Moocher is demanding that two-thirds of the funding come from the cash-strapped government, which would have to take out bank loans to finance Adelson's profiteering scheme. He's also got his hand out for special tax breaks, and get this, he's even demanding labor law changes so he can bring in cheap foreign labor to build and staff his Spanish casinopolis. This is Jim Hightower saying, what we have here is another example of the ultra-rich's extraordinary sense of entitlement. The dark secret of so many self-proclaimed producers is that, in fact, they're professional, world-class moochers.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
We took a concerted effort to go out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women.
Yes, binders full of women. Yes, that's what we found. They brought us binders full of them. What a dumb thing to say. I'll tell you. Just kind of makes you wonder. Interesting story out of Kansas. A Kansas City woman claims that she was refused medical treatment over her politics. The woman went to her gynecologist. And evidently in the gynecologist's office was a Romney Ryan sign. She claims that a conversation ensued and he basically told her, well, he told her quite frankly, I'm not going to treat you. There's the door. Nothing for you. If you're going to vote for Obama, I can't help you. And, you kind of go, is that what it's come to? I mean, I've had instances where I've talked to, doctors, I've talked to folks who, I can't believe you would support this, and you feel it at that moment. There is a real conflict. And, I've joked about my Tea Party dentist, who has now kind of walked back from the ledge. Having talked to him a number of times over the last couple of years, he's now walked back from the ledge of insanity. But still, there were some moments there where you're going, is this the kind of guy I want to be going to? And, for me, I'm of the mindset that, if you're a doctor, you keep your politics out of it. As long as I'm not throwing it at you, you shouldn't be throwing it at me. And, according to this woman, she had to sit through a whole dissertation about Obama being a Muslim and all kind of stuff. And she says, I wish I could have recorded it because it was insane. And she's like, everyone's entitled to their opinion, but, I'm here for a gynecological exam. What has that got to do? And you just kind of got to wonder where we're heading. And I saw Romney today. I saw a bit where he said that, And there's this belief, and they keep hammering on this $716 billion that Obama's stolen from Medicare. And you know what, you old people, you're going to call a specialist and you're not going to be able to get health care because Obama stole it. And that's what they keep throwing out there. I mean, we talked with Gene Stilpe earlier in the program. He's running for Congress in the 11th District here in Pennsylvania. And, you know, Barlotta has gone, the guy, the incumbent, the Tea Party, T-Twit incumbent, has gone after Gene saying, wow, you want to steal that? I go, wait a second. Let's at least talk about, and this is what bothers me about our political system. We can't talk about that $716 billion. Can't. Evidently cannot do it. Cannot have a rational discussion. Understand that during the Bush years, they created this Medicare Advantage. And it was very much an advertiser's dream. It's the advantage. It's Medicare Plus. Oh, it's better than Medicare. Because, it's the advantage. And what it was the poison pill that they put into the prescription drug bill to help destroy Medicare faster. You know, the whole point was let's destroy it. Let's privatize it, profitize it, get it into the hands of the for-profit companies. Because, look, that's their ideology. You listen to Romney talk about FEMA. Wow, if we can get it away from the federal government, give it to the states, that's good. But if we can get it away from government altogether and give it back to the private sector, oh, that's better. Yet no one's been able to show me where that actually has benefited me or you or work. I know it benefits people like Romney. But how does it benefit us as a society? It doesn't. And it's not supposed to. It's supposed to benefit a handful. So that your misfortune is someone else's profit. So when the hurricane comes through and wipes out your house and wipes out, you know, all of this infrastructure, someone's going to profit from that in Romney land, in conservative world. That's disaster capitalism. But they keep throwing this $716 billion out there. And understand, yeah, Obama is, the $716 billion number from Medicare Advantage is going to be reallocated. But you have to understand what Medicare Advantage is. It's the profitized version of Medicare. And when you realize that Medicare Advantage, the privatized plan, the poison pill plan, covers about a quarter of the seniors on Medicare, about a quarter. And costs more than traditional Medicare that covers three quarters. So, of course, they're going to offer a little bit better, and it's only a little bit better benefit. Let's not get carried away here. It's only a little bit better. But, of course, when you're talking about a quarter of the people covered by it and it costing more than to cover three quarters, there's a problem there. And you know what the problem is the profit. So when the president said we're going to take that out of that, we're going to get rid of that, we're going to stop that, we're going to stop doing the dumb stuff that was put into place by Bush, I'm in favor. I think it's a good idea. I think it's smart. Why do we need for-profit corporations? Why do we need them when we can do it for ourselves, as we have done in the past? But, you know, they've got this talking point. And the idea is to lie as often as possible. And then, you know, people who aren't keenly aware of what's going on but will buy into it. Because my grandmother called me, because she doesn't follow this stuff. She called me and said, I heard Obama's going to steal $716 billion from Medicare. What's going to happen to my Medicare? My granny, well, I know what you have, and you're not going to be affected one bit by it. Had you signed up for the Advantage plan, which, you know, to be honest, would have been a little more difficult with her health concerns, then you would have been affected. Then you would have gone back to traditional Medicare, which you have now. And she's like, oh, well, then what's all the hype? And I go, exactly. But when you sit and you explain it, then, you know, all of the air comes out of the lie. And that's what they're hoping. And look, you know, Romney's on the side that isn't being fact-checked. I mean, you've got 24/7 right-wing conservative talk radio pumping his message out there, pimping every word he says, and not questioning it. No question whatsoever. Like this ad that they just came out with. And it blows my mind. I happened to watch the ad that the Romney camp put out titled Bill's Barbecue. And it's about this barbecue, this small chain of barbecued restaurants in Virginia. And they closed for business in September. And the video tells you, hey, well, you know, it's all because of Obama and it's his policies. And, you know, we can't afford four more years of Obama and it's all Obama. And it's, you know, then you find out the person who is in the ad, you know, the owner who saw the company go under was a Republican operative, you know, one of the folks with the National Federation of Independent Businesses, one of the Gang of Six right-wing groups. And you find out through news stories throughout the last couple of years that, you know what, Bill's Barbecue was struggling long before. In fact, one of the statements that was put out is that, you know, they have been struggling for 5 years. And you go, well, wait a second. Obama's been in office only about 3.5, a little more than that. You're struggling for 5 years. That would mean that you were struggling before the Bush collapse. So you were having some problems. Again, maybe it's your management style. Maybe it's your business model. Because according to some of the reports there, other restaurants are doing just fine. And one of the blogs, Virginia's Finest Barbecue, one of the barbecue blogs there in Richmond, wrote, Bill's needed a facelift. It seemed they were stuck somewhere between the 70s and the 30s. The good old days for them. The success of a few other Richmond barbecue restaurants around town have slowly eaten Bill's business away. So basically what the truth is they didn't invest in their business. And you look at pictures of the restaurants, because they showed some of the pictures, and this is a place that, well, like I said, this is the 1970s. They didn't invest in new stuff and new technology and new anything. It looked like it was probably when they built it. And you know what? People tend to, you know, the free market, they tend to go where the, you know, the newer stuff is. And, you know, I look at this and, well, it fits a very interesting message, doesn't it? Even though the facts don't line up with what they're saying, it's all Obama's fault, it doesn't matter. It's the message that they keep throwing out there, isn't it? And it's all BS. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You know they're going to push us around. Mr. Pep and Diggin, Mr. Hardigan Hauling, because I'm going to leave it in the ground. Mr. Taft and Diggin, Mr. Harlequin Hall, and Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. He's gonna take a lot of long and an 80 short bit for his miner to cool on down. Mr. Taft and Diggin. Harlequin Hall.
So the for-profit media are now the story. Brother. Let's see. Let's quit shilly-shallying about and go to the phones. What do you say? The number, of course, you know, 304-658-3333. And on Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. A gentle reminder that we try to raise $150 every evening. That per the new math of our buddy Tom in California. He said that's really what we need to be looking at. $150 a night, so that's just 15 people at $10. 30 people at $5. We can do that. And to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Greetings from sunny Southern California.
Oh, rub it in, Tracy.
Do you ever feel like Penelope Pitstop and, you know, being tied to the train by Dick Dastardly twirling his mustache at times? I think.
And to trespassing in 2011. Harassment in 04, 09, and 10. Public real menace. And we keep hearing about the economy. It's the economy splitter. It's the climate stupid. Well, it's the stupid. Wow. Anyway, let's find out what kind of news is going around the rest of the world. I've got Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Bob, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thanks, Rick. Talk about being stupid. This is computer stupid in Ohio.
Oh, you know, again, I keep going back to this is not difficult. You need a piece of paper that gives you your choices and a marker, and you mark your choice. How hard is that?
I think you're right. I think we need to go back to paper.
And then you have something to count. I mean, is it that difficult? I mean, we go to Iraq and spend a couple $1 trillion to give those people the right to vote on paper?
Well, in Ohio, the amount of people that asked for absentee, it was a computer glitch, was over 1,000. They asked for absentees. There was a cross-check with the Bureau of Motor Vehicles to see updated data if they were who they were supposed to be, and it came back they weren't. So about 1,000-some people or more simply were ruled not eligible for absentees. Now, the question is, who are they? How do you find out? How do you count them? Do they go to Election Day? So in a state like Ohio with a razor-thin margin right now, this is not a good voter confidence issue. And then a lady pushed the button, supposedly, for Mitt Romney, and it came up Barack Obama. And so that happened, too, in Ohio.
Are you sure she pushed the button? I keep going back to it's the stupid, and there are a lot of stupid people. I mean, it's kind of hard to push the button.
Yes, and so I don't know what happened, but it's computer madness. It's just talk about timing. They've got to do something extremely quick.
But as a former Republican congressman, and you spent all your life as a Republican congressman and the party, all that, doesn't this play into the Republican Party frame that government can't do anything right?
Well, a computer sure can't, I guess. Maybe it does fit into the frame a bit.
I mean, because, you know, the way I look at it is all of these things that happen. I mean, you got Husted, the Republican Secretary of you know, all of this stuff seems to happen while they're in control.
Well, in this one, you know, the previous one was very controversial, Ken Blackwell, and then Husted didn't have too much controversy, but he's had some court battles. But right now, with the presidential election, this is doesn't bode well.
Yeah, where's this going to go then? I mean, you know, how are you going to find those 1,000 people, or who knows how many?
Well, there's that, plus the fact of the provisional ballots. There was a court challenge. You could vote in anywhere in a county. That was overturned. And then there's a question about people watching the poll. So it could be down to where if this really messes up, Rick, we might be talking a week later about who's president or not.
Is it possible that we could be seeing another 2,000 rolling out where we've got a Supreme Court who makes that decision again?
I surely hope not.
I mean, because I don't know that we could really stand that.
Yeah, and the corrections were made, you know, after that election to try to make things go better. But right now they're scrambling to make sure that the computers are up and operating. And, of course, then you got New York and New Jersey, which is questionable how they put up a tent and are going to be able to do voting.
Or even in Philadelphia, where they don't have power yet. There are a lot of areas that don't have power, and you got these voting machines. You know, hey, figure out how that's going to work.
Of all times for this to happen, so it's going to be a lot of controversy to the thing. And meanwhile, Senator McCain tried to stir up controversy on Benghazi, and I don't think that's going to work before the election.
Yeah, I keep seeing people saying that the media is not focusing on what's going on there. I got to be honest, I see tons of reports. Is it just projecting? I mean, is the Romney camp just trying to make sure that, you know, they keep hammering on it so that the media keeps covering? Because I keep seeing stories about it all the time.
Well, you know, the question is on the intelligence, and no one has said, well, I know there's an existing other document out there, so it's speculation, a letter written. I just don't think I think it was ginned up prior to the election. There might be something there, who knows, but the way it was handled seemed to be, I don't know, just seemed to be somebody looking to stir something up prior to the election.
Yeah. Let's talk about the storm a little bit. I see now Bloomberg has come out and said, you know, I saw the front of Bloomberg News, their magazine, said it's the climate stupid. You got Mayor Bloomberg, who has now come out and endorsed President Obama because of the climate change issue. What are you hearing in D.C.? Any buzz over that?
Well, today there was communication that, you know, this helped take the undecideds to the camp of the president. So I think it's, you know, definitely viewed as a positive. It's in conjunction with the mention of climate change with Henry Waxman from California, the congressman who is trying to now, during lame duck, at least get the issue going as a result of these storms. So it was very interesting when the mayor, you know, chose the topic of climate change, and then Henry Waxman, you know, saying that at least has to be looked into. But I think it helps the president with the undecided.
Yeah, and Romney was kind of, I don't know if it was heckled, but someone brought up the question of, hey, you know, these storms, what about climate change? And Romney didn't answer it. I want to play the you'll hear the guy ask the question.
What about climate? That's what caused this monster storm.
Is about the Republicans, and I don't know if it's I don't know that Democrats do that, but whenever there's something that they don't like, they just go into that chant. Now Romney never did answer the question about climate change. He never did make a statement on it, but you know, the people in the crowd, you know, they were wrong. Yes,
you know, it sounds like you could play that and say it's a rally in Iran.
Ow. No, but I mean, I listened to that and I'm going, well, he didn't say anything. The guy asked a simple question and Romney ignored it. And he had this look on his face like, you know, yeah, I know all you people are stupid. Go ahead. Go do your chant. I mean, is that something that comes with the card?
Oh, it happens a lot. People panic. Somebody yells out something. When I was in office, I'd go to a town hall or something. Somebody yells something at me and I was okay. And then most of the crowd would panic. It's just... these days, it's hard to disagree with anybody, I guess.
Now, I mean, you just can't have a rational conversation about this. And the sad reality is I haven't seen, I've heard some talk about climate change, but not nearly like we should be. And how, and all of that.
Yeah, you know, today's world, there's just not much comedy. There's comedy, but not much comedy in the culture or in any of the settings anymore. I think it's become so tense.
Yeah, and I think it's all come down to, you know, 15 and 30 second sound bites. And I just saw a story we just talked about a little bit ago, where, you know, we're it's the money, stupid. We've spent nearly $1 billion on ads during this presidential election alone. Nearly $1 billion.
That's amazing. That's why I do like radio. At least things can be sounded out, and you can talk about things a little bit more instead of, you know, something that's a numbing ad that and most of the time insults your intelligence anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I look at all this PAC money and all of this. It's just, I don't see how this United was the right decision. I don't see how it's good for our country. I think it's something that's going to have to be addressed. I just don't know that it will be.
Well, you know, John McCain took us down that whole fake road. It was a sham. There were loopholes in there that created more of the problems of, you know, of the independent expenditures. And, of course, United... Citizens United case, but it just didn't remove money from the system. It simply didn't do that. And people sat there and said, "Oh, wow, we've got campaign finance reform. We're all clean now." Far from it.
Yeah, I would like to see some kind of law saying, you know what, you can't start campaigning for an office 6 months out. We'll go 6 months. I mean, I know two is not, you can't expect that, but 6 months. I don't want 4-year presidential campaigns.
Well, the campaigns for Congress begin literally the day that you're sworn in, and independent expenditure ads run. It's become an amazing money world, and what it's doing is it's numbing people, and in a lot of cases it's keeping people really away from the polls because they're just sick of it.
Yeah, because, you know, I've got a lot of friends who go, I just don't care anymore. I just make the pain stop. I don't care who wins. I just want it to stop. And there's part of me that says, you know, that's what the big money wants. They want us to be disengaged. They want us to just to throw up our hands and be done with it.
I've had opponents in the past that we knew were running ads to the point to get people angry, to keep them, you know, from participating in the process because it benefited them. So there's strategies behind some of this.
Yeah. You know, the thing is I know so many people say, I hate all these negative ads, and all these negative ads are bad. We should, you know, nobody... But people seem to like the negative ads.
They hate the negative ads till they're played. Then they say they hate them, but they don't.
Yeah, I mean,
they listen to them.
When you start actually talking about issues, then, well, people tune out. We want... We served. We want blood. If it, like in the news cycle, if it bleeds, it leads.
The first election that I ran in for Congress, we simply did not respond to some very, very negative ads. Finally, the pollster said, you've dropped 16 points. And that woke my eyes up because I thought, well, we don't have to do that. And yes, we did. We had to battle back.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to get down into the primordial ooze, if you will, yeah, and fight back, I guess. Friday, tomorrow, the job number's coming out. Are we going to see them?
Yes. That was the biggest problem, is if they didn't come out because of the storm, but they're going to come out. And the preliminaries, came out today, and the unemployment rate's really not going to change. There's about 125,000 jobs they reported that were created in the report today. So I don't think it's going to be bad news. It could be better, it could be worse, but I think it'll be a wash. It won't be something that will be hurting the president.
And, I saw another story, and look, we're coming to the end of the year. They say that the debt ceiling will come up before the next inaugurated. We're going to fight that fight again. The payroll tax extension, that's going to come up again at the end of the year. If it doesn't get passed, I think 31 million families are going to see their taxes go up. Any discussion going on in D.C. about that?
Well, now, some people that are more towards the left don't like what some of the Democratic members are doing in the House, but I think it's a smart strategy. Some of the Democrats are saying, look, right now we don't want to tinker with that extension, but actually they're holding it too for a bargaining chip because the Republicans really, really, really want. So it's a strategy that they've gotten a little bit of grief for, but it shows you how they're going to have to maneuver right now because this thing's going to come to a crashing conclusion with the debt ceiling, which used to, by the way, Rick, when I was in Congress, we passed them. When Bush was president or Clinton was president, they came and they went.
I mean, why even have the debt ceiling at all? I mean, I'm just missing the, why have these battles? Why have this fight? Why not say, you know what, we pay our bills by, taxing people who, can afford it. Like we used to. I mean, we used to think this way. I mean, I think of the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower, the top tax rate was 91%.
Well, we didn't, we didn't fight over the debt ceiling, like I said before. It just wasn't an issue. You raised it, and then the appropriation bills are where you spend the money anyway.
Right.
It doesn't really matter what that debt ceiling is because you're going to spend the money or not in the appropriation process. That's where the battle comes.
And lastly, I see a story coming out of, Iowa, where they don't want the international observers to come in and look in on Election Day?
That's right. We are part of that system that's coming in, by the way, as a member of the UN. And they're coming in, and Iowa said, we're going to arrest you. You get near the polls, we're going to arrest you. Of course, we went over to other countries and observed them. We just kind of don't like them observing us. And maybe this election is like Gore versus Bush. I hope not. Maybe we need observers.
Yeah, well, we've got a state representative here, Daryl Metcalf, who he's telling the UN, you stay out of the Commonwealth. We'll take care of our own stuff.
Well, we're part of that process, so we actually pay to do this around the world, and now it's our turn in the barrel.
Well, I'm hoping somebody's paying attention. Bob Ney, I appreciate
Thank
the time.
You.
It's always great talking with
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, Rick. Bye-bye.
Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Earth, sky.
For decades, astronomers have been saying that our home galaxy, the Milky Way, was destined to collide someday with the spiral galaxy next door in the direction of the constellation Andromeda.
Now that someday has been assigned a more precise number, 4 billion years from now. Astronomers base this number on painstaking Hubble Space Telescope measurements of the motion of the Andromeda galaxy.
The Andromeda Galaxy is now about 2.5 million light-years away, but it's inexorably falling toward the Milky Way under the mutual pull of gravity between the two galaxies and the invisible dark matter that surrounds them both. When the two galaxies collide, these astronomers say, our Milky Way will get a major makeover.
And that's not the end of the story. Astronomers also say that long ago, the Andromeda Galaxy closely encountered another spiral galaxy in our local group. That's a collection of about 30 relatively nearby galaxies. This other galaxy is M33, or the Triangulum Galaxy. The astronomers say they can see a telltale bridge of gas between the two galaxies.
For a cool video showing what will happen to Earth's sky when the Milky Way and Andromeda collide, come to EarthSky.org and search for Andromeda Galaxy. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Free enterprise has done more to lift people out of poverty, to help build a strong middle class, to help educate our kids, and to make our lives better than all the programs of government combined.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program this evening, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So I saw the story, a YouTube video from Tuesday, put out by a guy, one of these right-wing conservative bloggers, who probably just needs a beating. I mean, I'm pro beating. I've always, and I think anybody who's listened to the program long enough knows that, you know, I do buy into what my grandfather always said. You know, sometimes you need to smack somebody every, you know, kind of make a citizen out of them. You know, a good smack, you know, turn people around. Well, this guy, this conservative blogger, I'm not going to bother mentioning his name, but he decided he was going to show those kids at Halloween, you know, what Obama wants to do. And he went and he set up his little area, and he started taking kids' candy, and he's showing them how to redistribute the candy. And I started thinking about this. I'm going, well, you know, hold on. First, they got the candy for free. So, I mean, it's kind of a little bizarre experiment. But secondly, when I was a kid, you would have reached your hand into my bag, you'd have come back missing a couple of fingers. And I wished, you know, and it's one of those moments where you wish, you know, some 12, 13-year-old would just pop him right in the nose. Then he would stop. I mean, you get so many of these conservatives, they want to make their little name for themselves. Because in conservative world, if you do that, that comes with a heap of money. And then you can be like them. Oh, not like them, but you can have a heap of money. And I look at this guy and I'm going, you know, these are these kind of people who just need a beating. And I know it's just politics. It's just politics. No, it's the destruction of our society. And it's, I'm telling you, people like this, a good beating. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like a tidal flood beneath the moon, our sway, imperial, mysterious.